trade and industry to recommend to Parliament what is happening with the asset which the people give us, which is their taxpayer money. We must be able to account for that, and then at the end of the day, ensure that it is spent wisely in order to stimulate the economy of the country, in the process create the jobs. As we all know that we are faced with a triple challenge. Others call it a triple crisis of unemployment, inequality, and all the other things which are related to that. But what is important here is that you are all welcome. And I see that the members of the committee are also correcting now. It means that the decisions they'll be taking will be binding. They'll be binding. They'll be final. So all of the members are welcomed in the portfolio committee of trade and industry. Secretary, are there any apologies for this meeting?
Chair, we have the apology from Ms. Fabs, from the standing apology from Ms. Oriani on Brucini, and Mr. Trin, who will not be able to attend today's meeting.
All right, sir. What is critical here? Honorable Farsi is abroad. She's involved with the SAEU issues. She's representing our country. So that we know very well that as we produce goods, we must sell them at the end of the day. So that we can end this forex and then be able to stimulate the economy of the country. All right, Honorable Farsi.
I will also only partially attend the meeting, and I will be running across to economic development.
At least you are still committed to the country. You will not be loafing around. Instead, you will be doing some job gain for us. Now, I think it's very important. So what we also like to do is to welcome the members of the department. I can see that the COO is around, Ms. Jody. You are welcome, ma'am. That's what I like with the DTI. They are always there when their entities are present, so that they always work as a team. So I don't know who's representing the credit, Export Credit Insurance Corporation. All right, from the list I'm having here, who's leading the delegation? I think the leader of the delegation is the one who must introduce his or her entourage.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Abel Mawela. I'm the Executive Director, Chairperson of the Audit Committee. With me here on my left, I've got Mr. Lesego Masupi, who's the Chief Risk Officer. At the back, I've got Ms. Lindelani Fafudi, General Counsel, and Ms. Zani Ndau, the Chief Financial Officer. Apologies from our chairperson, Mr. Joris Zani, and also our CEO, Mr. Kutwane Kutwane. They are traveling on business. Thank you.
All right, Honourable Members, the delegation which is in front of us, I think that I'll give them a chance now. All right, before I give them the chance to do that, can someone please propose the adoption of this agenda? All right, Honourable Gwabata, Honourable James has seconded that. Alrighty, I think the person is going to present on behalf of Export Credit Insurance Corporation of South Africa can fire on.
Thank you, Chair. As you have said, the contents of presentation will cover the performance review for 2012-13. We will also cover the latest performance review for the current financial year as of the 30th of June. It only covers one quarter because we are only going through the documentation for performance for the second quarter only now, so it's only due at the end of this month, so we have not finalized that performance. And then we will also cover the forward funding requirements for 2014-15 in terms of NCEF. As an introduction, the Export Credit Insurance Corporation is the official export credit agency for South Africa. It was established as a state-owned entity in 2001 in terms of the Export Credit and Foreign Investment Insurance Act, 1957 as amended. That tells you that the scheme of export credit has been in existence since 1957, but in the form of a separate SOE that's only since 2001. The mandate of the ECIC is to promote exports of South African goods and services by providing insurance. And to do that, and how we do that is by we specifically specify the level of SA content on the supported export contracts. I'll be going through through the presentation to show you how we do that. And then, as a state-owned entity, we are subject to the PFMA, the Companies Act, and we are registered short-term insurer. This slide just gives an overview of the organizational structure of, the ECIC. Essentially, we have four key areas covering risk, operations, finance, and legal, and the respective different units that that we have in the organization. In terms of the financial year ended 2012-13, it was a very successful year for ECIC. We met or exceeded all our targets in terms of the strategic plan. We grew the insurance portfolio by 58% to 17 billion. A component of that obviously was due to the devaluation of the rand against the dollar, because we do largely US dollar denominated transactions. And in doing so, we estimate that 2.7 billion of value-adding exports were facilitated in terms of the projects that we supported, and we also estimate that 15,000 jobs are expected to be created or sustained, again in terms of the exports or the projects that we supported. Our balance sheet grew by 1 billion rand to 5 billion, and we also achieved a clean audit. Going through the performance criteria for 2013, the first objective is to facilitate export credit and investment outside South Africa. Our key performance indicator there is the value of insurance applications that were approved by the board. Our target for the year was 600 million, and what we achieved was 953 million US dollars. And the number of projects were 18 that we had supported or that we approved by the board in the year. This slide just shows you the year-on-year comparison of board approvals since 2009, and you'll see that since 2009 we've been growing the value of approvals. And our year-on-year growth from 2012 to 2013 was roughly 40%. And then we also show comparisons of the targets that we had for 2012 versus 2013. And we're showing that even where we had grown the target by $1 million, we still managed to achieve a result that's higher than that target. In terms of the projects that we had approved, this is essentially where the business is happening. A large portion of it is obviously in Africa. That's our major exposure. Southern Africa comprised 89% of all approvals, followed by East Africa and West Africa. And then in terms of the sectors, mining is the largest beneficiary in terms of our mining-related projects. And that obviously follows through in terms of South Africa, which is largely a mining economy. And therefore, when you talk about capital goods and services, the exporters or engineers or service providers in the mining sector are the ones that we tend to be supporting. But following on from that is power. That's also growing, particularly in Africa. And also, in terms of this year, for the 2013-14 financial year, you will be seeing a slight change to this sort of sectoral exposure, where we're seeing more power coming into the picture as opposed to mining. And that's really coming from the infrastructure developments that are happening in Africa. The second key performance indicator under that objective is to look at the value of export credit or investment insurance policies that we signed. Our target for the year was $200 million, and we managed to sign 14 policies to the value of $769 million. And this is the year-on-year comparison of the different policies from 2009, and the composition of the different levels of the between export credit versus investment guarantee. And you see that in the 2013, which is the five, this one, we had more export credit policies compared to investment guarantee policies when you look at from last year. The third key performance indicator under this objective is to then look at the value of loans that we had disbursed for either export credit or investment insurance. Our target was $180 million, but we managed to achieve $1.2 billion of disbursements and insurance exposures. This slide shows the year-on-year comparison from 2009, also looking at what we had approved in terms of board approvals, looking at also the policies and the drawdowns. So we're saying that we are growing the drawdowns considerably from a year-on-year basis, so the trend is good, as well as the policies that we signed. In terms of the drawdowns and declaration in split by business lines and sector, business line essentially refers to export credits versus investment insurance. And from a export promotion perspective, our export credits are the ones that effectively contribute to increased economic activity in South Africa and jobs. So that's the number that obviously we look to, and that's also the projects that are supported by the IMU scheme. So you see that the split was roughly 5 billion of exports credits supported versus 7 billion of investment insurance, which also includes declarations or policy renewals. And then in terms of the sectors, you see that for export credits, mining, again, is the significant exposure, again, reflecting the South African economy. And that translates, obviously, into a number of the downstream exporters, manufacturers, or engineering service providers related to mining. And then on the investment insurance, we have roads infrastructure and telecommunications. Essentially, investment insurance relates to businesses where we support South African investors into offshore countries by providing them only with political risk. Essentially, it's to protect them from any political risk situations that may arise in the country that they're investing in. So the 7 billion reflects the level of investments that we have or that we're supporting for South African investors. And this slide just shows you a sample of projects and exporters that we supported. So Econet Wireless is a Zimbabwean telecommunications mobile provider. MDM Engineering is a mining engineering service provider. We also supported a boat building company, Ecraft, and the picture there of the boat, that's the type of boat that they were providing. And then one of the very interesting and exciting types of projects that we're doing, and it's recurring, is Grindrod. Grindrod supplies locomotives and wagons, and so it adds to the manufacturing capacity of South Africa, creates quite a lot of jobs. And then another exciting development is also Bell Equipment. Bell Equipment is a KZN-based manufacturer of heavy trucks for the mining industry. Again, focusing on manufacturing and job creation. Then obviously construction groups like Avenge, Consolidated Power is in the power industry. They build transmission lines and so forth. And then obviously the mining activities that we support. Okay, in terms of how does this then impact on the economy, what we do at the ETIC is we have developed a social accounting matrix model that's based on the level of exports or projects that we support. We calculate how much of that or which sectors are affected by that export or project, and then look at what are the multipliers across the economy in terms of those exports or projects. Now, in terms of the value of policies that became effective during the year, you see that we've grown that since 2009 and 10. So from 2009 to 10, the cumulative has been about 12 billion rands of policies that we've supported, and in 2012-13, it was 5.4 billion rands of policies. And that 5.4 then sort of translates all the exposure, or the 12 billion exposure is from a sector analysis is split between obviously mining being the biggest exposure, and with projects in terms of the countries would be in Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Tanzania, and you know, the many other countries. I have another slide that looks at the sectoral exposure of the ECC portfolio. And then in terms of GDP impact, so out of the policies that we support, this is our estimation of the GDP impact for the country, again based on the multiplier effect. And then our employment impact. So for 2012-2013, having supported 5 billion rands of projects or exports, we estimate that 15,000 jobs would have been created. And then since 2009-10, we're estimating that there would have been 48,000 jobs that would have been created or sustained. And then in terms of the analysis of the jobs by sector, most of the jobs are in the manufacturing as opposed to financial or business services, particularly for the projects that supported in 2012 and 13. And then in terms of the level of skill, we have obviously a number of semi-skilled labor and unskilled labor. So this is where you have, in terms of the types of projects that are generated, it's steel engineering and so forth. So you have a lot of semi-skilled labor in fashioning steel and so forth for the mining industry. And then direct manufactured exports. So out of the total of 5 billion that we support, we estimate that there was 2.7 of direct manufactured exports that were generated. And in terms of the fiscal impact, we're estimating that there was a 1 billion rand of fiscal impact. And how this effectively matters is you would have to look at the contribution, because what the contribution that the state makes in terms of the IMU, this is what it generates. The product, the insurance product, is provided as a cover, as an insurance product. So there's no physical funding that comes out of it. But the funding that comes out of the IMU, the direct funding from the DTI, is assists in being able to generate this impact from a jobs perspective and the economic impact perspective. In terms of the ECIC financial results and how the growth, obviously, in the insurance portfolio affects the ECIC financial statements, what we've seen is that our total assets grew by 28% from 3.8 to 4.9 billion, so that's roughly a billion rand of growth. And then our insurance liabilities grew by about 600 million in that period. And our trend is that over the last 5 years, we've been growing this balance sheet. And premium income also increased significantly in 2013 from 200 million the prior year to 700 million. Our second objective is to build mutually beneficial relationships with other ECAs or DFIs in order to be able to be better in delivering on our objectives. And our key performance indicator was the number of cooperation agreements that we had entered into with other ECAs or DFIs. And the target was to have two arrangements in place, which we were able to achieve with ATI and XCR. ATI is an African, Pan-African export credit insurer covering areas in Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania. And so this relationship will help us to be able to work together on projects. And then the other agreement or initiative was with XCR. XCR is a Russian export credit agency. We also participate in Ben Union and Pact Club. Ben Union and Pact Club are industry associations for export credit agencies, where we share technology in terms of how to do deals, we share product knowledge, we share experiences in terms of the countries that we are supporting. And ECIT, we also represent South Africa as observer member on the OECD Export Credit Working Committee. Again, that gives us an insight into how OECD countries develop their products, what rules do they apply, particularly on environmental and so forth. And then I've already talked about XCR and ATI. The third objective is to promote a professional and customer-focused workforce. And this essentially focuses on strengthening the ECIC in terms of its own staff, but also how it serves the customers. And I think one of the things in the comments that have come out of the portfolio committee has been that, you know, there's not too many people that know who ECIC is and what it does. And so we spend quite a bit of work and effort in trying to increase or elevate the level or the knowledge of ECIC in South Africa. So the first key performance indicator is to raise that awareness of ECIC, and we do that by engaging with various export promotion agencies and economic development agencies throughout South Africa, as well as doing conferences. Our target for there was to do 12 such presentations or awareness sessions, and we managed to achieve 29 presentations and to conferences and export promotion agencies. This is essentially the list of the types of agencies that we had contact with, and what we did is we focused obviously on the key structures of being able to get to the relevant people and entrepreneurs. So we focused on export councils and professional associations. We focused on business chambers in the different key metropolitan areas. We focused on government agencies and provincial development agencies. So for instance, in terms of boat building, SAVEX is one of the key agencies that we interact with. We meet with their members, and out of those meetings, we were able to obviously let them know about the product, what do we do, how do we do it, and the outcome of that is we're able to do our first boat building or boat transaction. So we're finding success in being able to access these entities. And then it also allows us to be able to go to all the provinces in South Africa, so we've been to cover all the 9 provinces. We speak to professional councils like the CISA Engineering Council. We speak to business chambers in the different areas in Johannesburg and Cape Town and Northern Durban. So it's been very effective in being able to get the word out there and get people to know what ECIC does. And then the next level of awareness is we participate in e-conferences that focus on structured trade and export finance in Africa, and also the mining endeavor. The mining endeavor has been a long-running sponsorship, and it's been quite successful in generating the type of transactions that we support. You have seen, you know, we do a lot of mining type transactions. So in the mining industry, you meet a lot of junior companies that are looking to build mines in Africa. We tell them about the product, and that allows them to source whatever they need for those mines out of South Africa. And we do the financing from here. We support, you know, those projects, and that creates jobs in South Africa. The second key performance indicator on this objective, again, is about doing a broad marketing awareness in terms of print media advertising. And our target was to run a print media campaign in at least two provinces. And we managed to do that with newspapers and magazines that have national and international coverage. And this is obviously, for us, it's a new area. We hadn't historically been doing advertising before. So last year was essentially our starting phase of doing it. And we are growing this activity. And internally, we've also appointed a marketing specialist that will be driving our marketing efforts and building an ECIC brand that is recognizable, so that we can get that word out there of what we do and how we do it. And last year, these are the publications that were able to place adverts or articles in, which included a publication called Invest South Africa, which talks about the opportunities that are in South Africa. And obviously, there's a lot of foreign investors and even locals that read that publication. And obviously the general media prints. One of the successful campaigns was obviously the business day, because we were able to get a specific inquiry resulting from that advertising that we did. And in terms of a profile of ECIC within our peers, we were awarded the best ECA in Africa by GTR magazine, Global Trade Review. It's the leading magazine for export credit internationally. And we also awarded, for the projects that we supported, we awarded the best projects for the year by Project Finance magazine. And this is the EdX Bioenergy project. The EdX Bioenergy project is a sugar cane to ethanol refinery project in Sierra Leone, which is quite exciting. We actually participate in that project with the IDC. And the other one was the African mining deal of the year for the Kwakola copper mine, which is the largest, one of the largest mines in Zambia. The fourth objective is fostering risk orientation, and that relates to creating an enterprise with risk awareness within ECIC, having an effective corporate governance and risk management practice. Our key performance indicator for this objective is to maintain our country exposure to a level that does not exceed 34%. And obviously the reason behind this is that we do very few number of transactions, but high value transactions. So we think that it is important that, in as much as we do our business, we need to be aware that we don't overexpose ECIC to very significant transactions, because if anything would go wrong, that means we would have to come back to government to bail us out. And our approach to managing the business is to be as prudent as possible by making sure that we still achieve the objective. So this is a significant objective for us. Not that I'm CRO. And the country exposure for ECIC currently, or as of the 31st of March, shows that roughly 74% of the portfolio is in Africa, or 84% is in Africa, and only 60% is outside Africa, so we've got a significant exposure in Africa. And our largest exposure was in Zambia, and that's mainly because of the Konkwaza Copper Project, because it was a significant deal, followed by Mozambique and then Zimbabwe. And outside Africa, we have exposures in Iran as well as Russia. So we monitor this exposure on a consistent basis, and we're able to achieve our target. In addition to that objective, I think because we are registered short-term insurer, we are required to comply to the Short-Term Insurance Act. The regulator for Short-Term Insurance Act is the Financial Services Board, and they have embarked on a project called SAM, Solvency Assessment Management, which seeks to modernize the supervisory or the regulation for the insurance industry from a prudential perspective, meaning they want to make sure that there isn't a repeat of financial crisis in the insurance sector. And so the approach to regulation is to come up with a set of requirements that seeks to strengthen risk management practice within the organization, and that's called Pillar 2. And then in terms of Pillar 1, to look at or calculate capital in such a way, or maintain capital in such a way that it reflects the risk that an entity is exposed to. And then in terms of Pillar 3, to have a robust reporting mechanism so that the regulator is able to identify issues early on and be able to manage them. And also to be able to report on a much more transparent basis to the public on the going-ons of the insurance company. So in response to that, we undertook a gap analysis of our risk management practices and governance framework against what the Act is expected to say. And I think the bill is coming forth to Parliament soon, so we understand it will be coming to the Parliament soon. So we've done this gap analysis, and we've identified the gaps, and we are currently working on it. And you will see in our strategic plan for 2013-14, we'll report specifically against this objective. The last objective for 2012-13 is to have effective stewardship by utilizing sound business environment and social principles. And our key performance indicator here was to develop and implement the social responsibility investment plan for ECIC. And that was also the target for the year. We managed to be able to develop the policy, which was approved by the board. Also, related to it, we established a social and ethics committee. And in terms of 2012-13, we had already started implementing on this policy. The details of what we are doing are in the annual report under sustainability review, but I'll cover essentially what it says. Our corporate social investment policy covers three key focus areas, which is welfare, skills development, and education. And the gears that tell you the size or the level of contribution that we make. So education is by far the largest contribution that we would provide, followed by skills development and welfare. So for 2012-13, we started with education. We spent 2.3 million rand on that, and what we did was to support students studying towards accounting, actuarial science, engineering, economics across the country. We also developed a partnership with an NGO in Gauteng that supports after-school learning centers for grade 12, catering for about 300 students. And these are the students there on the picture. You'll see that they look so beautiful, and they were very happy. And yes, so we plan to extend this program to other provinces. And in terms of where we are now. We actually last week were approving applications for the same similar scheme in the Mpumalanga province and also in Limpopo. So we, you know, it takes a lot of work to try and find these institutions that are doing after-school support, but we are finding them, and you will see the impact that they do make on the children. So it's one of our exciting projects that we do. And we also established an ECIC graduate program where we impart working experience to recent graduates. And in 2014, we want to increase the number of graduates that we're taking on. You'll see that ECIC, in terms of the number of employees, is very small. I mean, we, as at year end, we had about 47 employees in total. So there isn't so much, there's not much you can do in terms of doing graduates, but we think that it is important, and we'll be increasing that the number. We had only 2 graduates last year, but we're looking at increasing them. The second key performance indicator under this objective is to increase the value of procurement spend from BEE-certified suppliers. Our target was 70% of the value of procurement, and what we had achieved for the year was 93%. Last year, we did not have a BEE scorecard. So this is our first BEE scorecard that we did, and it came out at a level 5. And that's really because we had only good ratings for management, for procurement, but it scored very low on CSI because the CSI program happened after we did this score, as well as enterprise development. So we're developing those activities so that we can improve on the score. And this is a key performance indicator in our in the 2013-14 financial year. In terms of the employment equity achievements, you see that we have a majority of HDI individuals working for ECIC. We have more females than males working for ECIC as well, which is a good reflection of the demographics of South Africa. The third objective, or the third key performance indicator under this objective, is to develop an environmental and social policy. The environmental and social policy talks to the types of impacts, environmental impact or social impacts that our projects make. We operate on an international scale, and we need to ensure that these projects in the various countries that we support uphold the social and environmental principles that are enshrined in our constitution. So in order to be consistent in applying these policies, we developed a comprehensive social and environmental policy for public and private sector projects. Public sector refers to when we do projects with the governments in those countries, and private sector is when we do with private sector companies. And in terms of public sector companies, we benchmark the policy against the World Bank guidelines. And then for private sector, it's benchmarked against the International Finance Corporation. The IFC is a subsidiary of the World Bank, or it's related to the World Bank. And we developed the policy also in collaboration with EDC. So, we look to the OECD type approach in terms of how they approach their policies for environmental and social impacts. Our key financial information is there, it's just a summary from our financial results. So there's a lot of green, so it shows that we did quite well. Our operating expenses went up by 17%. That's obviously in line with the growth in the business that we were doing. A big portion of that increase was the marketing, which we'd never had before. we are spending on staff, attracting the right level of staff who are largely professional and so forth. And then we grew our underwriting profit. So even though operating expenses went up, we still managed to generate an 8% increase in profit. If you look at our financial statements, essentially, because we do a large number of transactions in or that are denominated in US dollars, the accounting statements require that we report our financials on a US dollar functional currency basis. So we report as if we are a US dollar company translated back into rands. When you do that, where you have the rand weakening against the dollar, you report a exchange loss. So you see that the exchange loss increased. That reflects that the rand weakened against the dollar. But on a rand functional basis, so you report against as if you are a rand company in South Africa, you see that instead of a loss, you're showing a exchange profit, which grew by 255%. And then the profit after tax is also different. So if on a US dollar functional, we're showing a lower profit, which reduces by 67%. But on a rand functional basis, our profit is 591. Okay, now we pay tax on a rand functional basis, so it means we paid a large amount of tax, which is based on 591, that number. In terms of our balance sheet, it went up. Total assets went up by 28%. Our investment portfolio and cash went up by 20%. Insurance liabilities also went up by 58%. I think it's much higher because of the increase in exposure that we had, or the growth in the insurance capital. And then free capital also went up by about 12%. And key financial ratios, our claims ratio is less than zero. What I mean is that our claims that we are paying are less than the salvages that we're getting. So we have more salvages than claims. It's very unusual, but it does happen for us because we don't pay claims that often because of the large transactions. When you do pay a claim, it will be a huge number. Because of the size of transactions that we cover. But then at the same time, if you then recover the claim as a salvage, they also tend to be large. So currently we are in a very good position where our salvages are much more than our claims. Our cost-to-income ratio went up by 27%, but it's still within the norm or the level that is benchmarked across all the other short-term insurers of about 14%. Our return on equity went up by 22%. So, in summary, we managed to achieve in terms of the mandate, increasing exports significantly, but we also maintain prudent financial. We were able to achieve a good financial result and being able to manage our risk. Going into the latest performance review for 2013-14 at the 30th of June. This only reflects one quarter of performance, but I'll give an update of where we are in terms of performance. So from the value of export, credit and investment insurance, and the objectives are still the same as what we had last year. There may be changes or there are changes in relation to some of the key performance indicators. So in relation to the first objective, the key performance indicator looking at how much we approve at the board or how much the board approves is now, if you remember, last year's target was $600 million, now $720 million. And in terms of that, for the first quarter, we managed to achieve $80 million versus a target of $180, so we were behind in terms of our target. But we have subsequently approved an amount of $488 million for various projects. So from 80, we've approved an additional $488 million. This is in the September board that we've just had about 3 weeks ago. And in terms of policy signed, as at June, we are quite behind. We only signed a policy of $7 million. And really the reason is that we, from an approval transaction to policy to a drawdown, is a lead time that's more than 6 to 12 months, because you approve the transaction and then you have to negotiate on the structure, the securities that that are required to be put in place for that transaction. And then only when that's done, then you sign all the agreements. Then after signing the agreements, then you then look at, okay, what are the preconditions before money can flow, and you have to put all those in place, all the necessary documentation must be provided by the borrowers and the lenders and so forth, getting all the necessary exchange control approvals. So it's a long process before we get. So last year was quite a good year where we managed, in terms of the transactions, managed to approve and get some of those transactions converted into policies and drawdowns. So we hope that we'll be able to achieve the same feat this year. And in terms of the value of disbursements and declarations, our target for the year is 216 million, and we had managed to disburse 121 million. Now the disbursements come not from the projects that we approved in the same year, but there may be other projects coming from the previous years as well. In terms of the, now for this financial year, we added two additional key performance indicators that relate to SMEs, because we also, in as much as we're doing these large projects, we want to also be able to support SMEs, small businesses coming in. And the target is to be able to achieve at least five applications that are presented to our committee. And that's in progress. We haven't received one yet, but we are working on that. And then we're also measuring this year the percentage of approvals that qualifies repeat business for exporters. And the target is to approve at least 25% of the total approvals as a repeat business. And so far we managed to achieve a $17 million approval, which is a repeat business. Our second objective, we maintained last year's key performance indicator of two agreements. That's still a work in progress. And in addition, we added another key performance indicator to look at specific initiatives that we generate out of these agreements. So as opposed to just having an agreement, what are you doing about them? So we are targeting to have at least 5 initiatives from our cooperation agreements. And so far we have initiated 2 training proposals with Sache and Becky. Sache is an Italian ECA and Becky is an ECA in Botswana. And this is in relation to a new product that we want to develop for performance bonds. So we haven't historically been doing, or we do have a product for performance bond, but it's been underutilized. So we're looking at what are the other ECAs doing, how do they structure their performance bond, how do they price them, and want to revamp our performance bond product. And this is the one that we want to be able to get SMEs to participate in ECIC. Then the other key performance indicator, which is new, is the number of brokerage agreements concluded to establish brokerage relationships. So we're hoping to be able to conclude 2 agreements or 2 brokerage agreements. And we've so far developed the policy, which was approved by management. Subsequently, to June, it was approved at the board level. And we are now in the process of developing a request for proposals in relation to this. Our third objective, we maintain the key performance indicator for last year and increase that from 12 to 15 presentations. And we achieve 18 presentations. So our processes have now improved, so we're able to, we already targeted the key agencies and export agencies, provincial development agencies, so we're just reinforcing the message of ETIC with those people. So that's going well there. Then we added a key performance indicator of producing research reports, and the target is to do 2 research reports, and that's still in work in progress. We added another target to improve our website and link it to other ECAs, okay, or other stakeholders. And our target is to have 10 website links, and that's still in progress. Another key indicator that we've added is to focus on BEE companies. How much are we approving in relation to BEE companies or BEE-owned companies? And the target is to approve $25 million, and we managed to approve an application of $7 million for a 50% owned BEE exporter. This exporter is actually involved in the locomotives and wagon manufacturing, which is quite exciting, and they've got a very strong pipeline in Africa to export these locomotives. The number of provinces covered by the ECIC in terms of marketing initiatives is 2 provinces, and so far we've managed to place an advert on the African Union 50th anniversary publication. The number of articles or interviews with media, 4 articles or interviews, and we recorded 1 interview with the acting CEO on the business day. We added a key performance indicator that's related to human resource matters in terms of the HR plan, and that related to things like staff retention, which for the quarter was above the target of 85%. Training spend was 21% of the quarter, so we are behind on that particular one, but it is work in progress. We're focusing on improving the level of training and courses that our staff are going on. Personal development plans for succession planning, so we had about 83% at the quarter that had completed that. Job grading, we needed to do a job grading to make sure that our salaries are benchmarked to the market, and that's been completed. And the outcome of that was actually quite good in the sense that we were largely on market. There were only less than 5 people or staff members that were affected, so it was a good outcome. The target to achieve 50% female representation for staff and management, we've achieved that. So the target is to maintain that level, and the representation for people with disabilities is currently below the target that we want. The 4th objective relates to country exposure. So from 34%, the target now is to reduce that to 32%, and we've managed to maintain that. Because it's currently 24.5% as of 30th of June. And then, as I said before, the implementation of SEM is a key performance indicator, and so far we are progressing well in achieving our objective of being compliant. The last objective in terms of CSI spend, our target is to spend 1% of profit after tax, which is roughly $5 million. So as at 30th of June, we'd only spend less than 1% of the target. The reason really that the majority of our expenditure for education for Basel is only in the beginning of the calendar year, which is between January and February. So a large chunk of that spending will be then. But year to date, we have found more projects which we are supporting from that sector. And then CSI program supported focusing on 3 focus areas. So we have identified 3 CSI initiatives and we're working on entering into specific sponsorship agreements and so forth. And then B spenders per the VTI code is now 100%, and our achievement for the quarter was 82%. And for the score, our target is to achieve a level 4. The current level is level 5, so for 2013-14 it will be completed at a year end. And so we hope with our CSI spend and enterprise development we'll be able to improve our BEs. And then in terms of timing of payment to service providers, within 30 days of invoice or statement, we've managed to pay 93% of all invoices within 30 days. Okay. Forward finding requirements for 2014-15. Essentially, the main request is in relation to the INU. So, in 2012, the National Treasury, together with DTI and the financial institutions, entered into a new INU agreement. The INU agreement is a scheme where the government provides an interest subsidy to financial institutions so that they can give a competitive financial package to exporters, so that they can be able to export their goods. Typically, you have an exporter, make an example. You have a mine in the DRC, the mine owner or the borrower wants to buy goods in South Africa. They've identified a South African exporter to be able to provide the goods. Now, the financing package obviously is subject to the bank being satisfied with the environment, the credit risk on the project, plus also the political risk. So as ECIC, we provide the political risk cover as well as the credit risk. So we make the environment suitable for the bank to be able to lend. So instead of taking risk on the borrower of the mine DRC, the bank will take risk on the ECIC. And ECIC, because of its government guarantee, is a better risk than the mine in DRC. But notwithstanding that, because it's a foreign denominated transaction in US dollars, the South African bank that operates in South Africa obviously cannot raise funds or US dollar funds on the same competitive level as an international bank. So the IMU provides that bridge that makes it the raising of funds for a South African bank to be as competitive as the international bank. And what it does, it levels the playing field from an international perspective, because the mine owner in DRC then doesn't have to go to Canada to get cheaper funding and export from Canada. They can come to South Africa with the support of the IMU to be able to build their mine. So that's how the IMU is important in the scheme. So the IMU is entered into between the South African-based financial institutions, the ECIC as an agent, the government, and the DTI. So the obligation comes from the DTI through the budget appropriation. So the scheme provides for cheaper prices for loans with a short-term payment period. In terms of these are the changes that were done in 2012. Before, you only used to get a specific price, because in terms of the scheme, we specify the rate at which the bank must lend the facility to the mine or the borrower, and at the specific level. And currently, it used to be LIBOR plus 2.5%. So the scheme now provides a relation between a loan that has a shorter term, so it's slightly cheaper. It's now LIBOR plus 1.8% compared to a loan that is longer term, more than 8 years, which would be LIBOR plus 6.5%. So it creates an attraction, obviously, for smaller exporters to be able to also participate in the scheme. And then the other thing is we've also introduced a fixed-term interest rate for long-term infrastructure projects, so you are able to provide a fixed term interest rate there. So these new changes plus the growth that we are seeing in terms of the portfolio and the demand from Africa from an infrastructure perspective, the awareness of EIC in the market will result in obviously the demand or increased demand on the IMU scheme. And those or that increase in demand will exceed the current budget allocation that's been made in the MTF. But our estimation is that the demand will only, or the shortfall will only happen in 2015-16. And the reason why there's that delay is because historically, EPIC has been having a fund, or call it the IMU fund, that was generated from another scheme, a similar scheme, in 1994, which was based on the rent test. Because in those days, the rent scheme worked on the basis that to the extent that the exchange rate was favorable to South Africa, the bank would have to pay in money into the scheme, and to the extent it was unfavorable, then there would be an outflow into the scheme. So it created an additional fund. And that fund, plus the interest, had grown to a level of about 600 million. So it creates a buffer for that bill. So the next slide shows the impact of how that fund will be utilized. So you'll see that at the beginning of the year, we had around 550 million in the fund. What we paid out was 191 million in terms of the annual. But over the next 4 years, that's growing. And in 2016, we'll see that the amount that we pay out will reach 554 million. The current MTF is red, which is showing 110 million for 2014, 110 in 2015, 115 in March 2016, which is obviously on the basis of the current inflation rate. But there will then be created a shortfall of 371. The difference between in March 2014 between the 323 and the 110 is paid out of the fund which we are applying. Okay, so that's providing a buffer in these 2 years, but in that year it will have been depleted and there will be a shortfall. And thereafter we say that shortfall, because that graph then stabilizes at around the 600 million mark based on our current estimate. And so it evolved in that shortfall on the IMU going forward from 2016. We had meetings with National Treasury as well, together with the DTR who were there and supported us. And given the information that we provided and the impact of the IMU versus the job that are created out of the ECIC product versus the economic impact, they were quite impressed, and it was quite a fruitful meeting, and they were very motivated because of those aspects to be able to propose an increase in the budget, and obviously there's enough time between now and then before we actually need to be able to increase that budget. This slide just shows you the IMU disbursements between 2009 and 2013, and you can see that it's been relatively constant for the last 4 years, but significantly now it's increasing. And this slide just shows you the movement between what we had at the beginning of April 2012, what we received from the DTR versus what we are paying, and the other components of the IMU. So the one that created the fund is this one that says profits from the Mozal IMU scheme. So this transaction it resulted in either a payment out or an inflow. But because of where the rent is versus an interest rate differential, it created this fund over the periods that we were supporting the Mozao product. And then also the interest that we are receiving under the fund. So our conclusion really that we're drawing is that obviously the positive impact of the IMU creates a strong basis and justification for the increased budget allocation going forward. What the government pays out of the IMU versus what you get from the jobs that are created from the economy impact is really significant. The increased demand for an improvement in efficiency of disbursement of the funds bodes well for the effective rollout of the export incentive scheme. And our focus on the African continent makes the IMU export incentive scheme a critical component of the strategic interventions required to access new exports market on the continent. And obviously, we all know that we need to diversify our export basket and lessen over reliance on traditional markets such as the EU. Okay, I think that's just a glossary of terms, and with that, Chair, I'll take questions.
Honourable members of the committee, I think we can see from the presentation here that the deepening of the African agenda is being realized day in, day out. And there's no other way except by integrating the continent and the region. I think that from the report, you can see that as we produce goods and services, we are being ensured that our exporters are going to get the cover. So what is our duty as the legislature is to ensure that we provide appropriate support for the work which is done by these entities. But this is not my report, it is your report. You have to engage with it so that we are able to take sober decisions in particular. As you can see that they do need some help, but I think that you must probe further whether you are happy with the progress up to so far. So I'll open now for any questions of clarity or comments for that matter. The first one is Honorable James. Honorable James, you are on the floor.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I just had a question about since you're a small organization, a vacancy rate of 18.9% involves 10 individuals in an organization with the total number of posts being 53. And just to ask you, does it worry you? I mean, what's your, do you have a policy to retain staff? What is the policy? Is that, I mean, is it an issue? And how are you dealing with it?
Thanks very much, Comrade Chairperson, and also thanks for the presentation, which is well cast and correct. I just want to point few areas for clarity. I think one is the broad socio-economic environment in the continent, the politics in the continent. Although we have taken political decisions, not only as a South African government, but also within the AU, that we need to revitalize the economy of the continent. But given the current situation of sporadic wars and the recent fiasco in Kenya, what kind of lessons for us? And because I've not seen even any challenge in your presentation, where we can say this is cited as part one of the challenge or a major risk that faces not only the South African economy, but the African continent. The second aspect relates to number of police imperatives, both of our government, the NEPAD and AU. And I know that currently President Zuma is leading the infrastructure project in the AU, because one of the fundamental issues that has been identified by African governments is that the issue of infrastructural backlogs is one of the major challenges that makes difficult for the regional integration in terms of the economy of our continent. Have you identified that as a niche? But I know that it can't be your responsibility to deal with all the legacies of colonialism. The third one relates to the renewable energy and the maritime industry. I think these are some of the industries that seems to be that they are going to take a lead in the 21st century. Is that not a niche? Maybe you have covered in the report, but you want to just unpack more in terms of the renewable space and the maritime industry. The last one relates to the shipbuilding. I've seen the presentation on boat building, but also shipbuilding is but one of the contributing factors in the economy, especially where you've got coastal lines. Is that not an option to look into? I think the last one may be the issue that relates to the performance in terms of the SMMEs. I think last week with the whole nation or the government convened a summit in terms of taking stock on the progress that has been made in so far as the PE. And with jealous regard in particular as the ANC, the consistency in terms of SMME and cooperatives. Because even if we want to grow the economy, but it's growing for who and for what? Is the growth been able to make a dent in terms of the triple challenges? Is the growth also assisting in terms of redressing the imbalances of the past? Thanks very much, Committee.
All right, Honorable McIntosh, and then followed by Honorable Zhao.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I had to step out for parliamentary work. It wasn't parliamentary work. I want to say I thought it was a very good presentation. I didn't hear all of it, but I skimmed through it. And I must say the departments bring us very helpful stuff. Just one or two things. Your organizational structure in your annual report is slightly different, not a problem to it. But the interesting thing about the annual report, and this is only said in jest, Mr. Chairman, is that everyone looks at it, the surnames anyway suggest that this very efficient business, because it is a business, is actually mostly run from guys who live north of the Vaal River. and so, which is not necessarily a bad thing, although coming from south of the Vaal River, I did notice that. But I really think, Mr. Chairman, we should congratulate these guys. They, of course, have a very long history in risk analysis and supporting South Africa's exports and trading. I think it's very exciting that they're moving into Africa. I must say, it's really great to get a report from one of our shall we say, it's a business because it is subject to tax and it's a company and it trades. But I think it was correct that the presentation is the beginning of it was presented by the risk officer, because, Mr. Chairman, we know what insurance is about, those of us who've been involved in it, and it's about risk. One has to assess a risk, and I think it's great. So I just wanted to affirm these people at LC know what they're doing, and we appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairman. Firstly, one observes that in certain areas, achievement in this report has been more than the target, which is really quite a very good performance in itself. It shows a dedicated team of people committed to ensure credit in the export part of our trade. There are just a few questions I'd like to ask, and these are mere innocent questions of clarity. On page 6 of your presentation, you make reference to job creation. Just to get a clarity as to what I view ECIC as an insurance company of some kind. What jobs and how, what role do you play in the creation of 15,337 jobs as an insurance company? Just to get clarity of how you link to those who may directly or indirectly create those jobs. And on page 39, you make reference to percentages. Where is your 39? I'm a little bit slow. I'm sorry about that, Chair. Now, these percentages can be in either two ways. So it's also just a question of clarity. You say here that 70% being the target percentage, value. Now on page 39, and you say the percentage value of the BE spent has been 93%. What one looks at is how do you arrive at the percentage? Is it 93% of 70%, which was your 100%, or is it 93% of 100%, which is something different there? And then on page 41, on page 41, on the equity achievement, there's reference to whites, and I look at whites as a race issue. How do you get them involved in this? In my view, whites, blacks, colored Indians, etc., would not have to play a role in an issue like this, and in a country of our nature, we would say white, black, Indian, and colored are South Africans. It's one issue. We wouldn't want to deal with race relations in respect to equity. We believe from the onset of our constitution does not recognize those particular kinds of areas. But you can clarify it. Maybe it is from a different angle that you mentioned the white in this particular matter. But also, when you look at the operational managers and the executive management, you seem to have very little of that as compared to your other staff. I'm not sure how you arrive at that imbalance. Because in my view, if these are percentages, In a place where you must have 5 managers and then you have 4, actually the gap must go high, because 4 out of 5 would be bigger than 6 out of 10. Just clarity also as to how you arrived at that. And the last being page 49. It's also just a simple question of clarity on the issues of the research. What would be the area of focus of that research? You say here the number of research reports produced by ECIS is 2, and that's work in progress. But just the areas of focus of the research, because just to get an understanding, These are all Blavatsky equations, all of them. Yes. Thanks, man.
Social responsibility. I think the last time was raised here that seemingly for cast in Gauteng, where all the resources are there. You know, Gauteng is the engine of Africa. Economically, it is the engine of Africa. But we have our own provinces, Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Eastern Cape, Free State, Northern Cape. When coming to the issue of helping of the schools, are going to achieve the target of reaching this area? Because we don't, but really, I also join my colleagues in appreciating the presentation and then exposing us on what they're doing, because I think the work they're doing is very invaluable.
Thanks, Chair. I will also request some of my colleagues to help me answer some of the questions. The first question was on our policy regarding the retention of staff. Yes, we do have a policy for retention of staff. What we've done, in fact, in this current year is we established a performance and a reward policy where we try and identify performance, and that's probably why the targets are so high. So we've developed a very extensive performance management system to track performance of our staff and reward them. On that basis, and from a retention perspective, we hope obviously when staff are performing and they were rewarded, plus the fact that we make sure that our from a job the job profile that we did is according to market, so we make sure that we know that we're paying our staff at the level that the market will pay them. We drive performance to make sure that they perform, and we reward them accordingly. And that we hope that is our retention. But also we also have the succession planning where we identify key staff and we develop specific succession plans for those key staff to improve their performance. As to whether the existing vacancy rate is an issue, The reason why, particularly on the financial report, you see the number of vacancies. In fact, those are new positions that we created last year, which we are in the process of filling. So, to date, I think there are probably one or two positions that are still outstanding. The one that's being that's proven to be challenging is the external position. Because of the limited skill that there is in the country. So I hope I've covered your questions on that. The second question was on politics in the continent, given the situation that's happening. We didn't identify it as a major risk, and really the question is why. I think we take that as part of our business. It's our business to look at political risk. Political risk is our specialty. So to us, it is a major risk, but it is our business. And so we look at opportunities. For instance, in the DRC, we have South African troops in the DRC that are fighting there. But what we then do is we say, well, given the country and where the war and the activities are happening, where the areas where there's stability. So we go deeper than just looking at the overall and say, hey, there's war in DRC, the country is not. So we focus and look at where the opportunities are, and we then go and try and support our exporters in those countries. So yes, we have a team that looks at all the countries. We focus on risks across the board. I think, for instance, last year when Mali blew up, and that was well, we were very big to sort of restrain the level of appetite that we provide to the country in terms of the applications that we're getting. So we respond quickly to the things that are happening there. The next question was regarding policy imperatives that government is running in terms of infrastructure backlog on the continent. And also you mentioned the North-South Corridor, which our president is leading. What we've done as the EIC is we participate in a forum between us, the IDC, and the DSA, as well as other departments, in the DTI, International Corporation, to look at opportunities that arise from an infrastructure perspective. So it's almost like a screening view of what projects, what potential is there on the continent, and we use those to be able to then identify a channel, provide advice, so that we can accelerate some of those projects to come to fruition. So yes, it is a key focus area. We do look at infrastructure and also the broader issues related to that. In terms of renewable energy, we don't have a specific policy that talks to renewable energy, but obviously we will support any exporter that seeks to do exports. We were able to obviously participate on the ADEX project, where it's an ethanol plant, you know, that's being produced out of the sugar cane, which is a renewable energy. There aren't a lot of South African exporters that do, for instance, wind and so forth. But generally, if those opportunities come, we will support. We have a project in Kenya where we have a South African investor participating in a wind energy project. So we are supporting that. It's not an export of South Africa, but it's a renewable energy project which we are supporting. In terms of shipbuilding, again, it's all about, you know, are there exporters in South Africa that are doing shipbuilding, and do they need support? And certainly we will. I think in terms of the key focus area, obviously, the boat building industry, they're largely smaller companies, and therefore they tend to need our support much more, and that's where we play quite a lot. In terms of performance in relation to the SME, I think your question is, you know, how do we make sure that we consistently support SMEs and operators so that, you know, as the economy grows, they also grow. I think what we've done there is obviously you would have seen in our key performance indicators to look at SME applications or exporters. The challenge obviously that we have is SME exporters, or most of SME exporters in South Africa, don't generally export into offshore. So if you have a big mining project, you won't find that it's an SME that's leading it. It's normally a large contractor that's leading it. But that large contractor tends to then have subcontracts with SMEs, so that's how they participate. So there's an indirect relationship there. But what we're also doing is we're developing new products, like the performance bond product, that will try and identify SMEs that are actually maybe exporting, but you find that they're struggling to post the necessary performance bonds or to their customers. So we're developing a product to support them there. The other initiative, which is still in research, is to look at a product that supports working capital for SMEs. So an SME will have a large contract to export, but they don't have the working capital to be able to build whatever they need in order to be able to export. So we're looking at a product that can be able to fit into that sector. We already have that product in the board building sector, but it was specifically designed for the board building sector. Okay. The question on how do we play a role in job creation? The role that you play in your contract, what we provide is insurance, and we provide insurance to a financial institution. But how that unlocks the jobs, effectively, maybe that's the right word to use, unlock, is that because of the cover that we provide, the political risk cover, the IMU that we provide through the DTI, it unlocks the opportunity for the exporter to be able to export those goods and services to a foreign player. And because without that, maybe that export won't happen. It will go to either another country or another institution. And that's really what we do. So by providing the insurance, we facilitate that those exports can happen. They are funded, because what happens is the bank will pay the exporter directly from South Africa, and obviously they will then use those funds to, you know, procure goods and services, employ people, build whatever they need to build so that it can be exported. And one of the customers where our product had a big impact with Bell. For instance, Bell is probably 1 billion rand turnover type of company. Now, when we supported them to do a transaction in Zambia, which was roughly 70 billion, that transaction almost required them to double their capacity because of the size of the transaction. So they were not used to doing such a big transaction to be able. So it doubled their capacity. It needed them to add more people to do the building, to do the manufacturing. And that's the creation of the capacity. Another example is Greenmot, who manufacture locomotives and wagons. Again, the support that we provided to them increased their capacity to be able to supply those locomotives and those wagons outside the country. So we unlock that capacity as the CIC. In terms of how do we arrive at the percentages for the BEE, it's actually 8% of BEE spent, calculated in terms of the scorecard, to the total amount of procurement that we've done. So it's actually 93% of total procurement that we've done, but it's calculated in terms of the scorecard. For instance, if the supplier is A level 1, that procurement counts 120% of the supply. So that's how we calculated the amount. Okay, in terms of equity question, why are we listing WISE? That's really from an employment equity perspective. So with the Department of Labor, they request us to provide employment equity numbers. And that's also another factor or a scorecard that is applied on the BE scorecard. So it looks at the number of, call it, historically disadvantaged as opposed to the total number. So it was really just to demonstrate the composition, of the racial composition of the company. But again, I agree with you. The main thing there is that the message is to show that the company represents the demographics of South Africa. Okay, the question on operational managers, I think on the graph, essentially what the graph is showing is the number of staff members. So it's not a percentage per se, but rather the number. So in total, we have, as of year end, we had 4 executive managers, and I think we had about 9 operational managers. And the number is split between male and female. So the point on the graph is to show that there is more female than male. From an executive level perspective, operational management perspective, and a staff complement perspective. The research, the focus of that research essentially is to look at what are the opportunities that are there on the continent. I think one of the areas that we thought maybe is not done or enough in South Africa is to say, because we specialize in college campus school, we look at these countries, we could probably use that knowledge, research capability that we have to be able to generate a report that specifically focuses on which sectors are South Africans exporting to, what opportunities are there in the different countries, and then use that report and distribute it to our key clients or and exporters to be able to help them follow those opportunities. Because also for us, it is, going back to the question around politics, there are countries on the continent where we think that they are very stable, you know, they're very good investment destinations, but maybe, you know, we're not having exposure to that. So as a way of measuring our concentration risk is to then sort of start elevating the opportunities in those countries and that sharing it across with our key stakeholders. And that hopefully will result in, you know, more projects or more opportunities or those opportunities being established in those areas. And that provides a balancing in our concentration exposures. Why are the targets so high? Why are the targets so low? I think in the document, what we also tried to do is to show the trends. I think we sort of anticipated that there could be a question like that. That that somehow we just seem to be exceeding this type. I think on the one, we come from a very low base as an organization. So for instance, in 2009, total approvals was $247 million. So what's happening is ETIC is growing, and obviously trying to peg at what, you know, where, what level becomes sustainable growth going forward is still something that we're still struggling with. Yeah. So yes, you know, we've consistently been, you know, surprising ourselves even, but also we've been also driving performance, a much higher performance culture within the organization so that we can do better, because there is a lot more that we can do to be able to drive this economic imperative of creating jobs. But at the same time, there are limitations. For instance, the IMU budget is a limitation. So we won't be able to grow consistently at this level, you know, if the IMU doesn't catch up. But also, that doesn't mean IMU must just be an unending increasing amount, because there has to be government has to balance priorities as well. So yes, it is a challenge. We have been surprising ourselves, but we think that it will be continuing. I mean, if we look at our pipeline, even going forward, you know, more and more projects are becoming even larger and larger and larger, because there are big developments happening in Mozambique. There's a huge project in the oil and gas sector that's happening. It's close to South Africa. We participate in that project. It means there's a lot of jobs that are going to be created in South Africa. You've got Zimbabwe, they're growing. There's a lot of infrastructure requirements that's happening there. So, you know, our neighboring countries are doing quite a lot of things. And so we think that we'll be growing. We think in the next 3 years, we'll reach $1 billion of approvals of projects. But beyond that, we think it will stabilize. Again, when you look at the pipeline of, for instance, the projects we see on the North-South Corridor, teams and the forums, again, they're very large transactions that will require some level of participation from ECIC. In terms of the last question, I'm going to ask my colleague Zani to answer that one on the schools.
Thank you. Thanks. I think on this particular one, I agree. Gauteng has more resources compared to other provinces. But how we went about was, we are based in Pretoria, and we looked around the neighboring townships, which is Mamelodi, Yososhanguve, and Harangua. And there weren't any after-school support. The center that we started and that we supported, we actually started them. But as my colleague noted during his presentation, the fact that 3 weeks ago we approved similar projects, after-school support in the Eastern Cape, in Mpumalanga, and also in Limpopo. So the intention is eventually to cover all the other provinces, but we just started focusing and identifying those areas that didn't have this type of support. So it's going to be spread.
Honourable McIntosh.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one short question and just a comment. According to the annual report, you still have an acting CEO. Could we hear what plans there are to stabilise the leadership of the bank? The second question or statement, Mr. Chairman, you know, this bank is in a sense, I think the closest analogy in the wellness world is a midwife. It doesn't have the baby, it doesn't raise the baby, it just helps the baby being born. So it's not a business in that sense, it's an insurance business. It's there to facilitate investment and business and so on. And you know, it's what one would call, I suppose, invisible earnings, but very, very important. And I must say, I've been very impressed, because you have given, I think Mr. Kuhlu came and gave some evidence here, that your risk management is very good. On what countries are like, where could you risk manage, what the companies are. And it was interesting, I just asked him, I said, do you have any investments in the CAR, in the Central African Republic? He just said no. As far as they were concerned, it was just a no-no in that country. So I think that's a good sign that you recognize there are certain countries which if they don't have certain structures or things in place, you don't lend money there. And that's good. I mean, that's what one expects. The one concern, you know, I think when you're dealing with insurance, one doesn't want to concentrate on the racial issue. But if we're into infrastructure, if we're into investments, if we're into places like Zambia, and I see we're also even financing to China, which of course has the famous statement, it's not the color of the cat that matters, but does it catch the mouse? Now, if anything, you're a service organization which is making sure we can catch the mouse. So my question is, in terms of risk analysis, do you include in that an assessment not just of the project, but also of the person who is asking for the credit on a racial basis? I'm not now saying you don't look at the structure of the company, and an ally to that is, do you, for example, that very rich Nigerian who's invested in our cement industry in this country, and who's very critical of BBEE, by the way. Now, have you given him any finance?
All right. I think we are coming to an end of this first session. And then the question of Honorable McIntosh is very clear. Do you consider... All right. Answer the question.
All right, thanks. Yes, the acting, or rather the CEO, has been appointed. His name is Mr. Kutwani Kutwani. He's a finance professional. He was running the housing fund that looks at housing agencies, so he's quite an experienced guy. And I think from the staff perspective, we're very happy about that, about how the board has appointed. We think they made a very good decision. In terms of the risk analysis, you actually have two questions there. We don't look at the racial profile of who's requesting the funding, but we do have a we do analyze whether the individuals involved in that transactions are listed for either bribery or corruption. So we use a World Bank database for that. So we do check whether, you know, we're dealing with the right individual. And in terms of your last question, yes, in fact, we did. There was a transaction we did 3 or 4 years ago in Nigeria. It was a cement project, Obasanjo, which was supported. It is fully repaid. So, yeah.
All right, honorable members, I think that we are coming to an end of the, as I said, of this first session. We know what the entity needs. It needs some sort of recapitulation when coming to the issue of the IMU. So I think that as when we prepare our BRR report, we must capture that. I prefer that each and every political party must go and reflect upon that so that by the time we make a report, at the stage of making a report, we make proper recommendations to the House. But what is very important about this entity is the way it is trying to make its footprint all over the provinces, in particular when cooperating with the development agencies like OFGC and all those things. I think that you are actually improving from what we had last year. It is very good that these things which you suggested to them, they are already practicing in place. Even the issue of the schools, I'm very happy that now they did go out, although they have not yet implemented that, but they did go out and they put some program in place to do that. But what is also very important is that the issue of the growth of Africa is, Africa can only do what is going to grow, the second largest growing area in the world. So with this BRICS summit which was there in Durban, I think that there are a lot of infrastructure projects which are in the pipeline. And then there's nothing is going to help us better than having our own people being able to participate there, because we want to have a single economic entity within Africa, but it can only be done if there's cooperation between the various countries. I'm very happy with the ECA of Kenya, whereby you have that partnership. And I think that how we can grow this continent, region by region, eventually cover the entire continent. So I'm very happy that you are really complying with what the president's directives are, is that really we have to expand towards Africa, and then encourage regional integration. There's no better way of encouraging regional integration by forging economic ties between, because once there are economic ties, it's very difficult to break them. It's very difficult to break, so we have already done that. But on the issue of broad-based like economic empowerment, that issue must be a way of life. It's the fact that we are coming from a particular past, that the people are not treated equally. Also, the entities are not going to be equal. So the task which I'm going to give you is that as you go back, reflect, let's say, I'm very happy that, because this is the export, we cannot delay the people already advanced. So what is critical here is that we're not trying to destroy the business which are already there. We must edge them forward, because at the end of the day, they bring the bacon home. They pay the tax home. We cannot destroy them. But if they're emerging, then the broad-based economic empowerment exporters, you must go an extra mile to help them. I think that's a critical aspect. Because the broad-based economic empowerment is a way of life in our country. So that at the end of the day, I think that by 2030, we must not still be speaking about black people. We must be sure that we have balanced our society. Yeah. So that the opportunities for everyone, not the past we're coming from. But already, your report is highly appreciated. You'll be given the support you need, because you have shown yourself that you are doing something on the ground, and it's highly appreciated. So, honorable members, we are going to adjourn for 15 minutes and come back in at 11:15 so that we can take the second annual report, that one of the NEF. So, yes, the chief, also attended, you can go and enjoy yourself and come back quick. Thank you. Annual report of the National Empowerment Fund. So, on my right-hand side, I'm having the chairperson of the board and the CEO. So I'll give the chairperson of the board as the overall overseer of the institution to introduce his and her age, and then we'll start looking at the annual report of the NEF. Over to you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairman, and also to the other Honorable Members for affording the National Empowerment Fund the opportunity to talk about, go through our annual results. If the Honorable Chairman wouldn't mind, I'll ask the CEO to actually make a few introductory statements, and then and we'll go from there.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. And I've also noticed that some of our friends from the media are here as well. Good day or good morning to you as well. Honorable Chairperson, our delegation today comprises, obviously, you have heard from our chairperson, Mr. Thando Shandiso. We also have our acting CFO, because our CFO is on maternity leave. That is in Sensha Belu. So we have Mr. Selvin Naika, who is our acting CFO. Selvin, can you please raise your hand? And then we have Hlakalani Mlepo, the divisional executive for the SMME and Rural Community Development Fund. And then we have Mzi Daimane, our legal counsel, general counsel. And then we have Lengwe Maxini, divisional executive for Umnoto Fund. And then we have we also have the Chief Risk Officer, Mr. Mohammed Mia. And then we have Mwemise Mudzibe, the Senior Manager for Communications at the NAF. Mr. Chairman, before I hand over to Mr. Nshambiso for his opening remarks, obviously our delegation wishes to register the NAF's gratitude to the board. To the Portfolio Committee for its wisdom and foresight in continuing to guide the NEF in its quest to bridge the economic divide as the primary hope of black entrepreneurs. Mr. Chair, I would like to take the committee on what I refer to as a fact sheet on the NEF, so that when a honorable member McIntosh and Honourable Member James, when they are asked about the NEF, they could use this fact sheet. You know, we'll develop it nicely, we'll put it on top of their desk. So what I would like the Honourable Members and the public to remember about this presentation today are the following key messages. We believe that together with other developers, including local and international entrepreneurs and GFIs, the NEF has built a portfolio of manufacturing and industrial capacity in strategic economic sectors. Those are the sectors that have been identified as the key drivers of growth in South Africa, especially if you look at the new growth path and IPEF 2 programs, which will potentially create or add 1% to South Africa's GDP if fully catalyzed, to the tune of about 5.5 billion. So these are the projects that we already have in our pipeline of investments. I know that in broad terms, it's always better to only say we'll actually support so many SMEs or so many companies, but what we have tried to demonstrate here is to say what kind of a contribution. For us, it doesn't really matter, Honorable Chairperson. Even if our contribution as an organization is going to be 0.00%, but we want to measure this. So we're saying to the committee that we are confident that because of the milestones and the significant achievements that we're making as an organization, that we're committing to this committee that all those projects, when you take them together, in 3 years' time will contribute about 1% to the GDP of the country. We also believe that over the next 3 years, South Africa could witness history in the making through the reemergence of brand new black industrialists who will have received support from the NEF. And I will be talking about these black industrialists. To others, when they talk about the need for the country to raise black industrialists, I know that they only say it in theory. Mr. Chair, I'm very excited to inform this committee that this is what we do on a daily basis. So this is not a theory to us, it's something that is very practical, and I will show the committee members how we have done this. So these black-owned companies will lead to the creation of more than 100,000 decent jobs and real investment in poverty notes. So Mr. Chairman, Honorable Chair, we're actually moving away from doing investments in the industrial hubs like housing. I know that it's always very comfortable and easy for most people to invest in areas like housing and the Western Cape. But what we do, even though we actually enjoy wearing our stilettos, but we also don't mind going to the rural areas. So we go to the rural areas and then come back to the city and wear our stilettos, and people will not even tell that we were actually in the rural areas. So we actually do that with a lot of passion and pride, because that's what drives us as the National Empowerment Fund. So, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of Parliament, these black-owned companies would drive beneficiation. How many people talk about beneficiation, but look at us, we're doing it. These black companies will drive beneficiation, increase South Africa's export earning potential, and reduce import dependency, thus fulfilling some of the objectives envisioned in our country's macroeconomic policies. So in, when we're drafting the BE, the broad-based BE policies in the country, and I'm very proud to say that I actually led that team in South Africa that crafted our broad-based BE policies. I remember there was a discussion on whether we believed that BEE development and economic growth were going to be complementary processes or not. And I want to assure this committee that based on our experience that we're picking on the ground, those three initiatives are complementary. We do not see how we can actually achieve the economic growth levels that we're envisioning as a country if we don't transform our economy, and we'll actually demonstrate to this committee how the NEF has delivered on this very noble objective of government. Honorable Chair, 10 years after the adoption of the Code of Good Practices, this is a critical moment which broad-based BEE now requires in order to drive inclusive growth in a meaningful manner. We urge the Portfolio Committee to proactively support the recapitalization of the NEF. When I talk about this, before I hand over to the chairman, my other plea to the committee members, I'm sure you were asking yourself, why is it necessary for us to introduce all the, you know, the executives from the NEF? What saddens me, Honorable Chairman and Honorable Members of Parliament, is that some people are taking us maybe 20 or 30 years back. For the first time, we're being asked a question on the identity of the executives of the NEF. I'm actually proud to say, in fact, it's something that I had never looked into before. The reason why I was introducing the members of my committee is because I wanted to assess to this committee that I have not employed Zulus at the NEF. Hlakalane is Pedi. Remember, I have never done this before. Hlakalane Mlebo is Pedi, but it's a question that we have had to respond to. Nzi Diamond is Xhosa, Sengwe Makatini is Zulu, Zelvin Naker is Indian, as you can see, Mohammed Mila is also Indian, Mwenise Mutepe is Sotho, and then we have another lady, Barbara Lombard, who is Kash. So that allegation is false. So that's why I wanted to, they will come to that question when it's raised, but I just wanted to put it on record that I have not employed Zulus only at the NEF, and I'll provide the statistics at the appropriate time.
So, honorable members, it is now my privilege to hand over to the chairman of the NES, Mr. Thando Mhlambisi.
All right, CEO, thanks a lot for that overview and the key messages you provided us with. But I want to bring to the committee's attention that here we are dealing with the annual report of the NEF. That's what we are dealing with. What will be expected from the side of the NEF? Let's go through the annual report. The annual report is very simple. It is, we want to see what are the products inside here, how we are moving forward. I think that's the critical aspect. But let's see, over to you. Thanks a lot, for exposing us to your team. It's good that have the full complement of the team, but we are not going to entertain the statues. What we want is here. That's what we have to deal with. No. Thank you. Over to you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and to honourable members. The one aspect of the annual report that I was going to speak to, Mr. Chairman, had to do with the corporate governance within the National Empowerment Fund. Now, I had thought, Mr. Chairman, I'll be guided by you, because of the media issues that have been around the NEF recently, I thought that I would at least address the body and let them know what the board has been doing in response to that. Would that be fine, Mr. Chairman?
It's all right.
Okay. Thank you very much. So, as the honourable members undoubtedly will know, a few weeks ago, the Minister of Trade and Industry, the Honourable Rob Davies, sent a letter to me asking, notifying the board that an anonymous whistleblower had levelled various allegations against the CEO and certain senior officials of the National Empowerment Fund. The minister then also requested that the board initiate an independent investigation into the allegations. So for the course of this time, the board has convened and tried first to figure out what was required to be done and then how best to exact our duties. Now, the honourable members will know that as required by the PFMA, the board was then actually required to pursue this cause of action. We then asked the audit firm Deloitte, assisted by Weber Wenzel, to determine in the first instance the veracity of the allegations and to submit a report to the board on its assessment. So that process has begun, and we'll see when Deloitte's report comes through. But based on the results of that report, the board will then decide whether or not further work should be conducted or if the investigation should cease. And obviously we will consult with Mr. Davies on those results. Now the key tenets of the length process are first, as the minister had requested, that it be independent. But the board also felt that it was important to attach a few other standards to that. The first being that it also be impartial, that it be thorough, that it be conducted as expeditiously as possible without sacrificing quality, and that it be done on a confidential basis. Now, one other decision that we made recently was that after having taken independent legal advice and after considered deliberation and pending the results of Deloitte's veracity report, the Board of Trustees decided not to suspend the CEO and the senior officials who are the subject of the allegations. The CEO and the senior officials, I think importantly, are cooperating fully with the investigation and have committed not to do anything to compromise its integrity. I'd like to point out here, Mr. Chairman and honourable members, that the NEF is an institution that abides by law and by the principles of good corporate governance. And so there are two, I think, critical aspects to that that have really been underlying some of the decisions that we've made, if not all of them. First and foremost, we are fully committed as a board
and as an executive and management to protect the integrity of the investigation. And secondly, we're also mindful during this period when Deloitte is trying to determine the veracity of the allegations themselves, we're mindful not to destroy people's reputations while the investigation is in process. Because there's also another underlying principle of law that we have to abide by, which is that people are innocent until proven guilty. So, you know, I think on this point, the honorable members must also take comfort in the fact that, you know, we within the NEF have a complex corporate governance framework and checks and balances, which I'll go through in a moment. But at the end of the day, if Deloitte comes through and they find that there are issues, you know, pertaining to these allegations in particular, and that our systems are found wanting, then we will not hesitate to act. So that's the comfort I think we'd like to give to the honorable members here. But I think it's very important for us not to prejudge anything. I must also say that, you know, on a personal level, I've worked with each of these individuals who've been, who have these allegations leveled against them. And I've never encountered anything for me to question their integrity. We'll see what comes out through the investigation, but for me, they serve the institution and the country with distinction. So I think it's important for us all to reserve judgment until the report comes through. What I'd like to go through, just to outline very briefly some of the applicable laws and policies that, that affect the National Empowerment Fund and that have been particularly important to the board in considering in this particular matter. Obviously, generally speaking, we have the NEF Act, the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act, and the PFMA. Those really are probably the most important pieces of legislation that we've had to consider, particularly the NEF Act and the PFMA, determining how to move forward on these matters. But within the NEF itself, you know, apart from these laws and other matters around good corporate governance, the board itself and the executive have put in place additional policies. So while on the question of potential conflicts of interest, for example, the law will require board members and others to disclose and to recuse themselves from, you know, any potential conflict of interest. Several years ago, the board and the executive took steps for us to where we held ourselves to even higher standards than that. By that, I mean that board members and employees are barred from receiving funding whatsoever from the NEF. So, you know, whereas the law will just simply require us, you know, to disclose if we want to receive funding and to recuse ourselves from that, those decisions, as the NEF said, that's not enough, and we have a much higher standard. So that applies not only to us, but also to members of immediate families. So those are the guiding principles on which the NEF has acted, conducted itself, and held itself for many, many years. And then I also just wanted to set out very briefly to give you a sense of the kinds of processes in which investment decisions have to go through within the NEF. So it's not a case of one or two people being able to make investment decisions. It has never worked that way. What happens is that you know, we go through several committees depending on the size of the investment, and ultimately, if it's large enough, it will go to the board. And then finally, you know, even once decisions are made, we have checks and balances around every one of these decisions as well. So these checks and balances first involve internal processes where we have internal risk, you know, finance, and so on, as well as, depending on the size of the matter, it will go through different board subcommittees. And then, again, overlying all of that, we'll have our external auditors that look through and check every one of these investments to make sure things have been done properly. And I think the comfort that we get at the end of the day also is that the NEF, since its inception, has received unqualified audit opinions. During most of that time, we had PwC as our auditors, and now we have Sizwe Nzaluba Kobodo. So, you know, as with any organization, though, even in the private sector, sometimes things can fall through the cracks. So we'll see what happens. If that does, if that in fact has happened, we will tighten our systems. The one other point that I wanted to make is just on this question of immediate family. Again, this is a standard to which we held ourselves to, which was higher than what the law requires. But we defined immediate family within the board as to mean members of a trustee's or employee's spouse or children. You know, one of the difficulties here was that is where do you draw the line if you say family member? And, you know, it could be very unrelated but still related family member who someone might not know of, should they be barred from, you know, receiving funds from the NEF. We thought that was going too far. So somewhere we had to draw the line, and that's what we thought it was important to do so. So on that, honourable members, I'll turn over the rest of the presentation to our CEO. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. So now let's get honourable members to the most exciting stuff, which is really about what we do at the NEF on a daily basis. We have inserted this slide here just to assure the honourable members that NEF has complied with the brief. This was the brief that we received from the parliamentary liaison officer. Next slide, please. At the outset, honourable members were also pleased to place it on record that NEF has delivered on government's promise to drive the quest for an inclusive growth in South Africa. The NEF, for instance, has evolved steadily into a leading, distinctive, and effective DFI in South Africa. So, and then I would like to urge the honourable members to actually assist us to take the NEF from where it is today, maybe for it to become like the IEC of this world. So that 20, 30 years from now, we can, I don't know if we'll still be alive, we can look at the work of the NEF and say, wow, we're actually part of the team that actually assisted the NEF to be where it is. So my plea to the members is to actually assist us to build this organization into even a more efficient and effective DFI in South Africa, but not to destroy all the good work that we have done so far. The AF has approved 5 million rands for black empowered entrepreneurs in various sectors across the country. The Strategic Project Fund, which I will talk about later in my presentation, has the potential to create about 100,000 new jobs within 3 years. That is if we receive our recapitalization, because we need to be in a position to follow our rights in the projects that we have already invested in so far. We have financed and nurtured 391 black South African ventures and enabled entrepreneurs to start their own businesses, to buy into and expand established firms, to build community rural-based entities, and to develop infrastructure projects. The NEF, honorable members, facilitated 87,000 black South Africans to become owners of MTN through the NEF, 1.3 billion worth of the Asonge share scheme. As a strategic advisor and a partner, we enabled 200,000 black South Africans to become shareholders in the Sasol in Zalo share scheme. I'm sure you're thinking, what is the partnership with Sasol? What the CEO of Sasol, it was the then Mr. Pat Davis, said to us was that he had actually looked at how we had rolled out the MTN Asonge share scheme. So he just asked the NEF to actually come on board and come in as an advisor to Sasol on the Sasol in Zalo share scheme. So that's how we ended up getting involved there.
And if you were to ask me, it's because of the good work that people are looking at, all the good work that is coming out of the National Empowerment Fund. We have developed a team of 168 experienced, mostly black South African investment and business professionals who operate in all of the nine provinces. In fact, we opened our office in the Western Cape with the Honorable Member James last year. And we're very excited about the work that is coming out of our office in the Western Cape. So we actually did that in partnership with the Western Cape government. So if it was not Honorable Member James, maybe it's somebody else. But we got a lot of help from the Western Cape government. The NEF is a well-managed entity that has built an asset base from 171 million to almost 6 billion rand. So we're talking about this report's cut because it's one of the questions that are coming from the honorable members. So we've moved it from 171 million to a net asset value of about 6 billion rand. Honorable members, the reality is that despite the NEF's many achievements since operational inception in 2004, the majority of black South Africans still remain locked out of the economic mainstream. Added to this is that our CDFIs, the IDC, DBSA, and PIC are no longer significant financiers of broad-based black economic empowerment transactions. The NEF is now the only major DFI that is well positioned to finance aspirant black South African entrepreneurs, but to do this, it requires recapitalization soon. I'm sure you are aware of the moratorium that was placed on the NEF about 6 months ago. So it means at the moment we have that capacity which could be utilized to drive the inclusion of black people into the mainstream of the economy, but this capacity is just idling. And we are actually experiencing a lot of attrition at the moment, you know, as an organization. Together with other developers, the NEF has built a portfolio of manufacturing and industrial capacity, which will potentially add about 1% of South Africa's GDP if fully capitalized. The NEF, Honorable Chairperson, is the only DFI that is exclusively mandated to grow black economic participation in South Africa. And to be able to maximize milestones, the NEF needs recapitalization so that it may stay on course as the driver and the thought leader in promoting and facilitating black economic empowerment and also for providing non-financial support to black empowered enterprises in South Africa. And added to this mandate is the need to continue promoting a culture of savings and investment among black people, which is what we're trying to do with the MTN Aslongeshe scheme. One of the most exciting moments for us when we did the MTN Aslongeshe scheme was when we launched it. Obviously, we had done a lot of marketing and advertising throughout the country. So when it was launched, I remember my colleagues and I, we went to the post offices around the country, so obviously I went to the ones in Gauteng. I just wanted to see, you know, whether there was this excitement that we had expected to see from the majority of people who participated in the offer. What was really touching about the offer is that on those queues you'll actually find ordinary black South Africans, your miners, you know, they will take their last 2,000 rand, their last 5,000 rand. Some of them were coming in as stockers to actually come and buy into the MTN as long as she's in. The reason why I'm talking about this is because I'd like to urge the parliamentarians to actually find more of these investment opportunities for our people. Because for some of us, you'll know that if you want to invest, you can always go exposed to the different investment classes that exist. But the excitement with some of our people is that they were getting this opportunity to invest in one of the prime investments in the country for the first time. So each time when they talk to us, they say, when are you going to have this another, you know, another MTN, you know, Aslonge share scheme? So I'm saying if our government could identify some of these investments, because we have the track record,
we have the expertise and the experience in rolling these retail offers in the country that would be more than happy to roll them out if the opportunity was presented to us. So, Honorable Chair, in growing black economic participation, the NEF pursues the two-pronged mandate. On the one hand, the NEF provides both financial and non-financial support to black entrepreneurs. We do that for startups. We do it for expansion capital. We do it for equity acquisitions and early stage or greenfield purposes. When I say we move from startups to providing expansion capital, acquisition, finance, and greenfield, I do want to highlight though this issue to the honorable members that when you do acquisition finance, which is still part of the codes of good practice on broad-based black economic empowerment, you do not necessarily create jobs. The only time where you are able to create jobs, especially when you implement AEE policies, is when you are looking at the provision of startup capital, expansion capital, greenfields or brownfields projects. But there is nothing so far that says you cannot support enterprises that are looking at getting acquisition finance. So I'm raising this because once again, I come here, I will try and explain these issues, and then you'll pick it up in the media and you'll think, but I was in Parliament just, you know, a month ago. So we are here. If there are any issues that require clarity from the honorable members, we will always make ourselves available. And that I'm not suggesting that all of our investments have been excellent investments, but just as a broad principle, it's not in all of the different areas of the broad-based BEE scorecard that we will be in a position to create jobs as a country. On the other hand, honorable members, the NEF engenders a culture of savings and investment in South Africa, which is what I have already spoken about. And the NEF implements the codes of good practice on broad-based black economic empowerment as outlined in the Act. In this regard, the NEF uses a sector-targeted approach in developing its portfolio, and these sectors include the renewable energy transactions. I will come to the work that we're doing in the renewable energy stuff later. We're looking at tourism projects, mining, minerals beneficiation, agro-processing, BPOs, and infrastructural projects. But before I get to the specific projects that we are doing in the renewable energy space, once again, my plea to the honorable members is that before you comment on any of the specific projects that are done by your institutions, I say we are your institutions because we are always here seeking guidance from the honorable members. You must just look at other entities, the private sector in South Africa, other DFIs. Look at how the renewable energy projects are structured so that by the time you are in a position to comment on the NEF specific renewable energy project, at least you'll be having a much broader understanding, and it will put you in a better position to then come to us and then say, I criticize this renewable energy project because it does not meet the following criteria. So I will come to that when I deal with the renewable energy project later. In doing so, the NEF specifically seeks to support the initiatives of the DTI, including IPEP-2 and more broadly the National Development Plan, by championing and funding the advancement of emerging entrepreneurs into black industries. So if you look at our suite of products, it starts with startup finance, it moves to expansion capital, it goes all the way up to acquisition finance and to greenfields and brownfield projects. So what we're doing, our long-term vision is to actually move our SMEs, if it will be an SME, our startups just from being a startup into becoming global players, not just in the South African economy, but in the whole world. So that is our vision. And I will actually show you some of those projects when we get to the project information. So the government priorities that we seek to support include acceleration of economic growth and transformation and creating decent jobs. And that's what excites us about our work. We're always in a very exciting mode and exciting environment.
So when we invest and then we're in a position to actually see how many jobs have been created as a result of our investment. We look at infrastructure and rural development. Rural development is just an area that I'm very passionate about, because at a personal level, you know, that's where my parents were, so I understand, you know, sometimes people talk about rural development, but I understand it at a very intimate level. Skills transfer and human resource development is another area that I'm very passionate about. And also what we're trying to do, even if our contribution, as I said, will eventually be 1% of the GDP of our country, we are making a contribution towards the creation of a developmental state. And when we do our work, we want to make sure that we improve public service delivery. So you can fault us on anything but not on delivery. So you can come up with any other issue, but delivery is what we do best. And you can benchmark us against any other entity of our size, form, and shape. So that's what we're proud about. In accordance with corporate governance, the executive committee, as the chairperson has already highlighted, we report to the board of trustees. So if a deal, a transaction goes well and we're in a position to create the massive jobs for our economy, I know that it will be tempting for the CEO to take all the glory. It's a collective effort. There is no single person out of his or personal volition who can just wake up one day and decide that you shall fund this transaction. We receive some transactions, some people will even come, go to the minister, they go to the parliamentarians. If the transaction does not meet or comply with the key criteria of the NEF investment policies, will not do it. So if it goes well, we take glory. If it goes bust, also as a collective, that includes the board as well, it means we would have made a wrong decision as a collective. So therefore, honorable members, the CEO is responsible for the operational implementation of the mandate. So that is our day-to-day responsibility. But at a strategic level, the board of the NEF drives the strategic direction of the NEF. I thought I would just give the board a breakdown, so I know the question because I saw it from the previous presentation, a breakdown of the employment equity level of the NEF, which will show that our employment patterns will mirror the demographics of the South African society. So if you wanted us to also, you know, break it down a little bit more, as I have already highlighted when I started my presentation, I would be very happy to do that. So please don't listen to some of the media reports sometimes. That's time and ask for the facts, we'll give the facts to you. Oh, honorable members.
Members, can you give the chance to make a presentation?
So the target, honorable chairperson, for the women component is 90%. A question that we wish to answer here today is whether black people are good enough only for small businesses. The NEF, honorable chairperson, says no. It has to be a two-pronged strategy. Yes, black people should be involved in the SME side of things, but we are very concerned about the fact that in South Africa, you actually don't have a Dangote from Nigeria. We do have a lot of BEE companies that are involved in quite a number of exciting opportunities and investments in the country, but we don't have a black industrialist whom you could look at and say, wow, maybe 5 or 10 years from now, we could also have somebody like a Dangote. So we're hopeful that with the investment that we have in our pipeline, that 5, 10 years from now, we'll definitely have 5 or 10 Dangotes in South Africa. I'm sure you all know who Dangote is. So we say no because broad-based was conceived as a cross-cutting strategic solution to the historical and systematic exclusion of black people from South Africa. It is our assertion that black enterprises should not be confined to a periphery of the economy, because if we were to just use the demand-driven approach where we'll just wait for the people who knock on our doors, it would mean 10 years from now that the NEF will just be financing the Kentucky Fried Chicken or Nando's. I'm not saying there's anything wrong in financing those projects, but we want to move our people from the periphery of the economy into the mainstream of the economy. So we do a lot of hair salons, but we're saying we actually want to see, especially black women, I always encourage them to say, because when you go to those massage when you're stressed after a long presentation from your entities, so I always say to these ladies that they must actually go and build a spa which can be the size of maybe the life day spa. They should be owned by black women or just women, you know, because when you go to these bars for a facial or a massage, it's actually when you go there you only find women. I've never seen a lot of men, but they own the spas in the country. So that is why, honorable members, together with other developers, the NEF has built a portfolio of manufacturing and industrial capacity in strategic economic sectors. So it's the only DFI mandated exclusively to provide financial and non-financial support to black enterprises, the NEF fulfills a unique role as the implementer of BEE code. So when you take an equity stake in a company, that equity interest will be regarded as black equity. So our funding ranges from 250,000 to 75 million, and our thresholds are actually lower than those of the IEDC, but higher than that of CIFA, the new Small Enterprise Finance Agency. We are also different to the GDFA, whose principal focus is infrastructure development. Obviously, you know what the commercial banks are doing. You know, a lot of them are very risk averse. We actually do provide finance into some of the projects, doing it in partnership with the commercial banks. But what usually happens is that where the NEF or the IDC will be taking an equity position in a transaction, a lot of the commercial banks only want to come in as senior debt lenders. They don't want to actually take the risk that is associated with equity financing. So we always say as a country, there's a lot of money in the country because as part of the financial services charter commitments, a lot of banks are required to set aside a portion of their funding for BEE financing. But the one thing that we have not unpacked as a country is the form of this financing that is going to be given to BEE companies. So a lot of money is available, but we don't have sufficient seed capital finance and equity financing. What this slide demonstrates, Honorable Chair, is that the NEF has four dedicated investment funds that provide financial assistance to all sizes of enterprises by black people, regardless of whether those enterprises are big or small. So which is why, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, it is correct to say that the NEF is not empowering the already empowered. The NEF empowers black entrepreneurs who have viable and sustainable business ideas. Over 60% of the NEF investees are SMEs. Our investment portfolio comprises rural and community development initiatives, SMEs, established businesses where black companies would be taking equity stakes in established businesses, and businesses that seek to advance entry into predominantly white sectors of the economy. So that's what would actually drive some of those investments. One of the most important milestones, and this is like one of the, you know, I always say, we all have, when we come into these positions, we have, they give us contracts. I would say when I was in government, I can look back and say whether these BEE policies 100% correct or not, but when I look back, I say, wow, you know, I did the BEE policies of the country, the codes of good practice, so that was my legacy. So the legacy, if the honorable members of Parliament were to say to me, we think you have done what you had to do now, the 4 years is over, what is the legacy that you are leaving behind? So that's what I'm going to tell you about, and it's very exciting. So I really want to see the excitement on your faces as well. So what I said, Honorable Chair, is that one of the most important milestones of any effort over the last 3 years has been the establishment of the Strategic Projects Fund. So we did this because we wanted to give effect to government's injunction regarding the need for the country to maximize job creation. Remember, a lot of our work is demand-driven. So we're involved in SME, but they were only able to create 3 or 4 jobs here, 7 jobs there. We were not in a position to make this massive contribution towards job creation, which is why we came up with the Strategic Projects Fund concept. So the SPF, as we refer to it, honorable members, has been created to seek competitive opportunity for the South African economy and the inclusion of black participation in opportunities at the outset of projects as opposed to doing so during equity closure. So we're saying, as opposed to persuading and encouraging black companies to go and just buy a stake in an established company, we just thought this was an ideal opportunity for us to involve our black entrepreneurs during the feasibility development phase of these projects. So some of the projects were initiated by the NEF, so we'll actually come up with a concept and say, why is South Africa importing a lot of poultry products from, I think our poultry products are coming from the US and Brazil. So then say maybe there's an opportunity here for our cooperatives and our community and rural development initiatives to make an investment. So that's one example. The other one would be in situations where some of our people got land through the Land Requisition Act. So you find that in the communities, they are sitting on a piece of land and they wouldn't even know what to do with that piece of land. So I'm not saying those types of skills that they currently exist within the NEF as we currently speak. So what we'll do, we'll go to those communities and say, so what can we do with this piece of land? If, for instance, we believe that it's part of the arable land that can be utilized to plant whatever, we'll then go and work with specialists and experts, agricultural scientists, who then also we pay those people, they are our partners. They will go to these communities, assess the land, assess the soil, and then come back and advise the NEF and say, we believe you can plant berries here, like there is a project that we are doing in partnership with the IDC. We started the project from scratch because even though we always talk about rural and community development initiatives, the fact of the matter is, honorable members, our rural communities can't develop feasibility studies that would then allow them to access some of the funds that we are talking about. So those are some of the things that we are doing under this initiative. So the other objectives of getting involved in the FTF environment was to create new manufacturing and industrial capacity. It was to create massive jobs as opposed to replacement capital finance. It was also about making sure that we find a way to invest in new fixed capital into economically depressed areas of the country. It was about making sure that we create an inclusive economy by increasing South Africa's participation. I'll show you the exciting projects later. So I said when we do these projects, we use a sector-targeted approach in developing this portfolio of investments. And I was talking about renewables, minerals, mineral beneficiation, agro-processing, DTOs, and infrastructure projects and tourism. So, honorable members, the total portfolio size of the NEF strategic projects fund is approximately 33 billion rands, with projects from infrastructure, green economy, and mineral beneficiation. I need you to take a pause. This is the most exciting part, because 33 billion rands worth of projects that were initiated by the NEF. And we are thinking, with our limited resources, with the capital constraints that we have, how did we manage to use the leverage that we have to actually create this additional value for our economy? So what we do in these projects, honorable members, which is contrary to what has been reported, it doesn't mean that we have physically invested 33 billion, because we don't have that on our balance sheet. So where would we get 33 billion from? So what we do in some of the projects, for instance, we'll invest 10 million because that's the seed capital finance, or invest 50 million where the project, because when we develop these projects, we actually conceptualize them, move them from feasibility to pre-feasibility, bankable feasibility, and all the way to financial close. So when the project moves along that development cycle, that's when it becomes exciting and interesting to your foreign direct investors, because I'm sure they would have told the honorable members that everybody wants to come and invest in South Africa, but they always complain that, you know what, when you guys go to, guys meaning us, not honorable members, when you always talk about your country, yes, you know, we think the country has done a wonderful job in terms of fixing your macroeconomic policies, your fiscal policies, monetary policies, and all of those issues, but we are looking for bankable projects, and this is what we've done. So when the project moves from one level to the next, that's when it's with an interest in your foreign direct investors, because in some of them, we started some of them from scratch, and as the project moved in that development cycle, that's when we're then in a position to actually get other investors, not just international investors only, but other investors from South Africa as well, whether they be commercial banks or other investors who also maybe come with the type of technologies that we'll be looking at. So this was the exciting part that I was referring to, because for us, we believe this was mind-boggling. So our equity rights in these projects are estimated at about 5.5 billion rands. So Honorable Chairperson, if we're not able to actually get our recapitalization, what will be good about the project is that we have created additional value for our economy, but we lose the equity rights that the NEF has in those projects. So if the NEF loses the equity rights in the project, it means it's taking us back to square one as a country, because we are holding those equity rights on behalf of our broad-based beneficiaries that I was talking about earlier. So we are in the process of exploring potential co-financing and syndication arrangements with both international and local strategic equity partners, including DFIs like the IPC and the PIC. Honorable Chairperson, I have to say that because I serve on the IDC board, but also because of what the real value that the NEF has created to the economy, the IDC and the PIC are actually willing to come on board and assist the NEF, because they are telling us that there is just no way that they would sit back and look at what is happening to the NEF right now, where we have this capacity that is not being utilized to the fullest. So we are in the process of negotiating a fund with the IDC. The only thing the IDC is waiting for now, they've conducted the due diligence on the NEF. They've done, I think they were in the NEF for about 3 months, and they were very excited about the type of work that we are doing. So the NEF is now, Honorable Chairperson, willing to come and invest about a billion rands into the fund. But we need to get approvals from our shareholder ministry and the National Treasury. We are not going to the fiscals to say, please come and assist. We are also looking at other sources of funds. We are not saying, if the National Treasury were to come and give us something, we'll say no to that. All we are saying is because of the work we're doing, everybody is willing to come on board and support us. So the key message to the honourable members today is to say that there is a facility that has already been negotiated with the IDC, and if we can just try and find a way of fast-tracking the approval. The actual approval we need from the National Treasury is the one that will give us the limited borrowing powers, because in terms of the NEF Act, we cannot go and borrow. But otherwise, they've conducted everything else that is related to that facility. So one example, honourable members, of these projects is in infrastructure, and specifically in the healthcare sector. So I'm now giving you specific examples of the projects in the Strategic Projects Fund environment. Here, this is where we can point to a project that is valued at 1.2 billion rand and where the NEF has invested 135 million. So we take the stake, and then 3 or 4 years from now, we'll then offload that equity interest to a broad-based grouping. So as you may be aware, honourable members, South Africa's healthcare sector is dominated primarily by three large groups who control more than 75% of the total market share.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask with respect to yourself and to this very good presentation, but if we could, Mrs. Zimtet, Kshesharangani, please.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right, honourable McIntosh, although you are not recognized to speak, I think that you are the manager of the big time. But I think that I can see that this presentation is over. So we'll request to institute a sharp up and
But it's not the chair, because when the gentleman was here, the honourable member gave him, because he's the man, more time. But they gave him 2 hours.
we've already passed the 1 hour mark.
Oh, I have.
Yeah, we've already passed. So what is critical here?
Okay,
is that the critical aspect is that the members must engage with the report. I think
that's
We've had this report for some time. The members have gone through it, to honor. They've gone, we've read that, you know, we've gone through it, and then we like a background, you know, mm-hmm. what you've given. But
Thanks, Chair. So the Busa Holdings intends to be the first black-owned hospital group to compete with the big three in South Africa, and the first hospital is going to be here in the Western Cape. So this talks to the creation of black industrialists that I was talking about earlier. SA Metals Equity, this is a project that is valued at about 1.9 billion, in which the NEF invested 40 million. So here, once again, we believe that this is where the NEF can demonstrate its role in terms of creating industrial capacity in South Africa. This one is very much in line with the ICAP 2 program and the new growth plan. You can read the rest of information at your leisure. Thinfilm Solar Technology. This project is valued at 1.1 billion. But honourable members, the NES only invested 5.3 million because it was once again, which is very sad, honourable members, reported that we have invested 1.1 billion rand in one project. And this was coming from one of the honourable members here. There is no way the NEF can ever be in a position to invest 1.1 billion rand in one project. This is the NAV of the project, the net asset value of the project, but our investment is only estimated at 5.3 million rand. So this is the project that is located here in the Western Cape. So please, before you attack us in the media, just ask us for some information, we'll give it to you. In mineral beneficiation, Menhaze Coking Coal, based in Limpopo, is valued at 1.4 billion. We have not invested 1.4 billion. The NEF has only invested 6 million. So what our funding does, it leverages additional funding into the project from other funders. So please, once again, make sure that you quote us correctly, because the public listens to honorable members when they speak. So we are always at your disposal. Whenever you need additional information, we are more than willing to do that. The Finesse Energy is in Limpopo, is an entity that holds a fuel wholesale license from the Department of Minerals and Energy, specializing in the supply of fuel. This is an investment which involves a procurement contract from the Department of Minerals and Energy. This one has not created the number of jobs that were envisaged when we financed the project. But if you look at what is in their pipeline, we're very confident that in a few months' time, this project will have created quite a number of jobs for our economy. Honorable Member, the Roger EMT Technical Services. The irony of this project is that it was referred to the NES by the Western Cape provincial government. They also attacked for this project. We thought when the Western Cape government referred the project to us, obviously we had to take it through our own investment processes. We thought it was a very exciting project. The business has a unique competitive advantage over its competitors because it's 100% black-owned and 50% women-owned. It offers a turnkey operation for mobile classroom units, and we got it from the government of the Western Cape. So with the Honorable James was recorded as wishing to know why this investment has not created jobs for the economy. The NEF investment, Honorable James, supports and maintains...
Not the individual member, because it will be chaos. If we can change that, we'll take it.
Okay, the investment, thank you, Chair. The investment, the NEF investment supported and maintained 88 jobs. So, Chair, once the NEF places credence on commercial viability, our mandate also focuses on softer measures in assessing applications for funding, and these include broad-based black economic empowerment, and by that we mean a project must look at all the different elements of the BEE scorecard. It looks at the women component of creation. It looks at whether the project is happening in some of the growth sectors of the economy, geographic spread, and the investment return. We are pleased to report that the NEF has met or exceeded 74% of the stretch targets for the previous financial year and stretch targets checked. The NEF had a significant increase of its funding activity, having approved 135 transactions, the highest ever in the history of the NEF. If we're not faced with the current challenges, our targets want to move from 135 to 200 transactions per annum. Clearly, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of Parliament, our systems and processes have reached maturity. An area of concern for my colleagues, and as I need to encourage, we need to encourage higher women participation in our funding. Some years has been better than others, but the women are not coming in the numbers that... So, Honorable Chair, since 1st of April 2012, the focus has been on the building of the pipeline because we don't have sufficient funding, whereas on 31st March 2012, we approved deals that were worth about $3.7 billion. All we're saying is we could have grown this number significantly if it were not for the current challenges we're faced with. I'm also pleased to place on record the performance of the NEF in terms of the approval and disbursements by value areas which have shown phenomenal growth. As at 31 March 2013, the NEF has approved a cumulative value of just over $5.5 billion, having disbursed $3.6 billion. And when I was appointed, Honorable Chairperson, to head the NEF in July 2005, that was led by two capable males at the time, the NEF had only approved 18 deals that were worth $35 million, and I'm very excited and proud to report to this committee that we have actually grown that portfolio from $35 million to $5.5 billion. By number, the NEF has now approved 519 black-owned businesses with disbursements to 417 of these enterprises.
and Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of Parliament, this is a far cry from what I found as the CEO in 2005. You must remember the NEF was set up in 1998. If the NEF had been recapitalized, these figures would have been much higher than what we're reporting today. And as a custodian of hope for entry into business, as a funder with soul, Honorable Chair, the NEF supports a diverse range of business imperatives across all sectors of the economy. The neckline is on the geographic spread, just to actually show the parliamentarians, honourable members, that because of the work that we're doing in the provinces, for the first time, the focus has shifted from Gauteng. It used to have a much higher weighting in the past. The next slides, I will take them as read. Women empowerment, I have spoken about that. Job creation, just to mention that we've created 40,000 jobs with the money that is coming directly from our balance sheets and the 100,000 jobs that I was talking about earlier when I was talking about STF. Reasons for the increased pipeline, I think I have already highlighted most of these issues, that indeed we believe that the NEF is a high-performing organization that employs young, dynamic, and highly qualified investment professionals that we are very proud of. So on the way forward, slide 49, Gwenise. The previous point should be considered within the context of the following matters that are currently progressed: the possibility of the NEF being recapitalized, the possibility of getting additional funding from other BFIs. And by the way, Honorable Chair, the funding arrangements between BFIs are also regarded as best practice in South Africa, because sometimes you'll see that when the IDC, for instance, was raising money for their renewable projects, they went to the PIC. So the PIC has given the IDC $10 billion. So what these DFIs are saying to us is that if this limited borrowing power capacity can be resolved, that they can also give us a small portion of that amount, because they are saying you have built the infrastructure, you have the track record, you have experience and the expertise, so why would it be necessary for the PIC to go back to the drawing board when the NEF has already build this capacity internally. Market failures, I've spoken about the market failures even in the past, I won't go through that. The importance of SMEs, this is common knowledge to the honorable members. The funding criteria, I think I have already touched on that. The funding products, I've already spoken about the fact that we provide conventional entrepreneurship to franchising, procurement funding to project finance, expansion, so it's across the whole development cycle of a business. And then on the land financial support, Honorable Chair, just to say the NEF intervention is not only limited to the provision of financial support, we also provide non-financial support, and we are responding basically to the constraints that are faced by some of the black entrepreneurs who are not able to develop top quality business plans. So a business plan for us is a major constraint, because sometimes we say access to finance when in fact our people struggle in terms of putting together a viable and a compelling business plan. So with the business plan toolkit, everybody can now go into the toolkit. It's available in most of the African languages, because sometimes you can have a good business concept, but when say produce the business plan, you know, it becomes something else. So if you go to the business plan toolkit, it will even tell you what is the balance sheet in Setswana, for instance, or financial projections. When people do it on a step-by-step basis, they can actually see that it's not a rocket science. On mentorship, we also have a mentorship program so that we can follow our investments once the NEF has already invested in those entities. We work with a team of highly experienced professionals throughout the country. It's mostly your retired white professionals.
Some of them were engineers. They are sitting at home, so we'll work and tap into those skills to say to them, can you actually assist some of our investee companies? That is where the NEF would have invested. These are some of the key insights and lessons learned which were covered at the conference. Last week I won't go through that. I've spoken before about the ED fund, and we are very grateful for the contribution that we received from the Western Cape government. Examples of the ED fund's success among the many partners that the NEF, for instance, has attracted to date under the ED fund would be Daimler, Willy Chrysler, Bagwena Van Kupa, UK Trade and Investment BP, International Council of Swedish Council Industry, just as an example. With regards to the impairment provision that was also raised, Honorable Chair, there has been an incorrect reporting in both print and broadcast media that the NEF has written off 290 million. So I'm raising this so that when it's raised in your settles, you can be in a position to actually talk to this issue. This is factually incorrect. 290 million is reported in the 2013 annual report is not written off. It is an impairment provision, which means that's just an accounting standard. Those are the, you know, the transactions that are sitting in the ICU. In fact, there's a big one that was sitting in that portfolio that would be moved from the portfolio into a normal transaction, especially when the transaction is now in a position to repay its loan installments. So that was an impairment provision. So when we talk about write-offs, that's when we refer to a process where you cancel the amount outstanding. So we have not cancelled those amounts. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, with your permission, I think I will stop here and take questions from the Honourable Members.
All right. Thank you, CEO. I think the members now have the full gist of the report. But already, I think that what I'd like to say up front is to appreciate the input made by the chairperson of the board, that all the other issues which were raised, they are still going to be dealt with, they are not a subject of discussion here. And then what is the also the disadvantage of this committee is that we don't know the nitty-gritty of what is being investigated. You guys will know. No? So if there's any question around it, something which is still under, please indicate to me so that it cannot be a subject of discussion. Because with, as the chairperson has said, the constitution guarantees the rights of the people not to be judged adversely before the actual thing has been proven. I think you guys know what is what. Yeah? So that's the first aspect. And then the second aspect, really, I'll appeal to the members. We're dealing with the AR report. Yeah? There's the annual report, the BRR process, because what we're going to discuss and take resolutions of must give us an indication how our BRR report is going to look like. So I appeal to have that restraint on the side of the members. But really, really, one thing which I've seen in this report, or heard in this report, which is really puzzling, from disbursement of about 85 million in 2005 to 5 billion that the women can spend.
That was for sure.
You know, no one can. Honourable members, this is your meeting. Honourable McIntosh, Honourable James, Honourable Marmarve, in that hall.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I do want to say I was very reassured by the Chairman of the Trustees, Mr. Mklambiso's statement. Thank you very much for that. And I see he's a senior executive at Allen Gray. Mr. Chairman, for the members of this committee who are looking at what they do with their pensions, a friend of mine said in the early 1980s, somebody said to him, buy a property at Plettenberg Bay on the beach for 100,000 rand, which was quite a lot of money then. And he said, I don't have enough money. And then he met this guy again. He said, today that property sold for 23 million. And he said, you know, I'd worked out, if I put my 100,000 with Allen Gray, he didn't buy the property, by the way, but if he had put the 100,000 with Allen Gray, today would be worth about 1 billion. It's good to have a wise investor of the idea. Mr. Chairman, I really do forgive an enthusiast a lot, and the CEO is a great enthusiast, and I think she's doing a great job, but she must please be a bit more sensitive to our time constraint. And then the other element, which I think is quite clear, and obviously her concern, because NEF is her special baby, and she wants it to do well, was she wanted to convince us all that we must give her more money to recapitalize her. But I'm pleased to see there are other possibilities. IDC is looking at it. And I also, in a sense, have a link there to Mr. Trumpy, so to ask him a question. Would NEF not consider listing under the Alt-X section? So in other words, go to the stock market to raise the money. If you look on page 32, you're sitting on this asset value of over $5 billion, and if Mrs. Mpertois's calculations are correct, then you're going to become even worth even more. So you could be quite attractive if you went to the stock market. I'm not suggesting you don't retain possibly a control in some way, but if you went to the stock market, you could possibly raise your funds there. So that's a question for either him or Mrs. Mpertois. The other point I want to make, also, because I think this is a great report, and I think we should try to find him the money, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to recommend to the minister and somebody, because what is this doing? And what I liked on page 10 is a want to go for modern capitalists. Now, I must tell you, it's important. We are quantum law more here today. But I must advise Mr. Chairman that the members of the Congolosi, that's with one exception, are all trade unionists. They don't find successful capitalists comfortable. But I think you are doing a great job, and I believe we'll move South Africa forward really well. And I don't have a problem with this emphasis on black, because I think it's got to be part of the portfolio. It must open opportunities for black people, and I think that's what you're doing. I've got another thought on the BBEE legislation, which is another story, but I think an organization like NEF should be encouraged as strong as possible. And what I like about it, because one of these bumper stickers on comp taxis are very interesting, but one of them often comes up, nothing for Mahala. And the comp taxi guys are the real entrepreneurs of South Africa. They're often uneducated, but they understand property rights, they know how to do business, and they take risks. And I think those more modern South Africans is who NEF is encouraging. So I really think you're doing a great job. Just one last thing, be careful about quoting Dangote. He wouldn't have been happy with that BBBEE summit. Because Dangote says he's not interested in the color of your money, at least not in the color of the guy who brings the money. Bring the money, bring the investment, and everything else will follow. Because he believes that our situation in South Africa actually just turns away a certain foreign direct investment. But Mr. Chairman, I want to say good luck to NEF. Keep on the work, and I want to thank again the Chairman of the Trustees for this reassurance, because it's very troubling when one of our important organizations has a cloud over it.
All right, Honourable McIntosh, I think that you'll find that one of the unionists who turned around Brazil was Lula da Silva. So, you know, unionists, they tend to be good leaders and good economists. All right, Honourable James.
I think, thank you, Chair. I think the Honourable McIntosh is looking for a job. If I can thank you for your presentation, I'm a Member of Parliament. I happen to represent a particular party, and I have nothing to do with the government of the Western Cape. So the fact is that as an MP, my responsibility is oversight over parties and entities part of the executive, which you represent. And therefore, we have the right and duty to ask questions, and that's not an attack to ask questions. So if I can step away from a little constitutional lesson to say that there is obviously the forensic investigation underway, and that will take its own course. And I have asked a series of questions, and that will take its own course of the parliamentary process, and we'll get some detailed answers from that with respect to every one of those questions. But you've illuminated some of the answers already in your presentation, and I thank you very much for that. Now, the big issue has to do with the fact that is that the NEF received $2.4 billion from government in 2005, and you've spent now all the money to the point where you cannot, you spend it all investment and financing decisions, and you're coming back for recapitalization. And therefore, we're looking at an entity, an institution that, in fact, has spent down all of its money and has kept nothing in reserve and has suspended all decisions with regards to investment a few months back. And it raises fundamental questions about the quality of management when you are taking care of the money that you've had in this manner. So that you couldn't make any decisions, I don't know how long ago, anymore. So if anybody comes to you for additional grants, then you cannot respond. So if you could explain what kind of organization does that in terms of the management of the money. And in particular, since taxpayers' money is being spent, and therefore the salaries that are in the public domain and in the public interest, it's hard to understand how easy the CEO can earn what she does, including a bonus and performance payments for $1.5 million. It's an issue that requires explanation. So I'm asking for an explanation in terms of the management of the money and an explanation for the payment of bonuses under circumstances where, in fact, what you're looking at is a bankrupt organization. So those are the questions. And so I would like to leave it at that. Thank you.
Any Honorable Bernard Merve, followed by Honorable Waile.
Thank you very much, Chair, and I want to concur with the Honourable McIntosh that this is a good and an impressive presentation with incredibly good work being done. I also am grateful to the Chairman of the Board for his initial introduction, which I think has helped us to understand that the processes will carry on, and our job here today is to look at the report as well as the presentation that has been made here. The one area that interests me particularly is the question of leveraging the finances that you are putting into various projects. You've listed them in the slides to start with Busamed and SA Metals and the thin film solar technology stuff. You've alluded to the issue there of how you put in an amount and then the asset value is created through that initial seed funding. There's a new word from research that's been done recently called gazelles. I don't know if you're familiar with these gazelles. In other words, these are small companies, a small amount of them, who have the potential to grow jobs and the economy faster, that's why they're called gazelles, than just anybody. And what interests me is the relationship between the kinds of money that NEF are putting into businesses and the criteria that you use that will illuminate whether those little companies are going to be the gazelles. You know, the gazelles being the Springboks or whatever, the fast-growing companies that will actually leverage the financing that is being provided. So the question really is a rather long way of putting it, but the question really is one of the criteria in funding projects its capacity to duplicate and grow the economy, but jobs and sector even. So that is what I'm interested in. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Waile.
Thanks very much, Commissioner Chairperson. And let me also echo my colleagues in terms of appreciating the report because it deals with specifics, but also what we must take into consideration is that we must appreciate the role of this government in terms of all attempts of redressing the imbalances of the past, but not under conditions of our own choosing. I think that becomes important, because some of these milestones are not just falling from the sky, because there's a particular vision that what kind of South Africa that we seek to build. But it's also quite a bonus for us to see that some of the institutions are consistent in terms of ensuring that the strategic objectives of this government are being met from the developmental point of view, but also from the economic point of view. And I think few areas which I would like to highlight is the issue of the rural areas. I continue to raise serious concerns. A number of institutions that presented the strategic biasness to Johannesburg is understood because it is the economic hub of the African continent. Yes. But however, I want to argue that the apartheid legacy has affected a number of areas. And if you go to some provinces, you find that some other provinces had two and three Bantu stands. To what an extent consciously are you taking decision in terms of dealing with that legacy? I know in the past a similar answer was given in terms of the provincial spread was that because offices of DDI are in Gauteng, then it becomes easier to access funding. That can be a model and the measure. That response was simplistic. I'm raising this thing, you find that there are provinces like Northern Cape, Eastern Cape and others, which continue to supply a number of people in terms of migration. Because if you look statistics South Africa, there's a migration from Eastern Cape to Johannesburg and Cape Town, which is not sustainable in the long term. Because some of the studies begin to indicate that by 2050, two-thirds of the population would be in cities, and that we cannot regard that as a sustainable development. So in essence, it's an issue how do you strike a balance on rural and urban development. I'm raising this thing because if you go to Eastern Cape, you'll find that there's been this one's called Dimbaza, which was a project of the former Prime Minister, the late Sebe. If you go and check Dimbaza, there's still an infrastructure, but you'd find that there's a lot that you can do. You can go to Kakadu, you'd find that there are nuclear projects. How do you ensure that we reposition ourselves in a manner that can ensure that those projects are well planned but also well coordinated? The second area, what are the lessons from Brazil? I'm not raising because the chairperson raised the issue about Da Silva Lula, but it is a fact that after a trade unionist who became a president, comrade Da Silva Lula has turned around the economy of Brazil. But we are told that Brazil has made a number of strides, especially around the SMME development, including the youth empowerment. Are there any working relationship between yourself and certain institutions, both in Brazil and India? In one of the sessions I was given an example that in India, you find that there's a dairy cooperative, whereby that dairy cooperative has got people with 1 million cows that supply the milk. I'm not saying these are some of the lessons. I'm not saying that the same can be applicable in South Africa. One of the strategic areas is a partnership with local government, provincial government, development agencies. Because we find that right across number of municipalities and provinces, they are struggling in terms of responding to economic turnaround of their own provinces, including issues of empowerment. I'm raising this thing because in the GDS process and the PGDP processes by provincial governments, there are a number of milestones that have been highlighted. But when I look in terms of your presentation, they are the integral part. But is there any kind of working relationship within the context of the intergovernmental relations? Thanks very much, Committee.
Honorable Silau.
I'm on cooker's mode. Also echoing sentiments already raised by my colleagues that it is a good report. But I also believe that it came at the right time, you know, at the time when we are grappling in South Africa with this whole problem around job creation and the establishment of ownership of the means of production by the black people of South Africa who are at the moment in the periphery of the economic development, the regional integration within our continent, the infrastructure development within the continent, and the economic growth that we need so much. But as well, I think it's good that it shows that the ANC rules this country without fear or favor. If we must be able to do something in the Western Cape and allow our state-owned entity to fund it, it just funded. We are funding projects in the Western Cape. So it came really at the right time for that. I think we need to commend it. The only worrying factor is that it is also at the end of the term of office, and we cannot really be sure if it will be pursued further by the other colleagues after elections, in order to ensure that certain of the things that this report is requesting to be done can be followed up. Unless we are able to do that between now and the elections next year, May. Chairperson, I just want to ask one little question around this, and I'm not asking it the first time to NEF. I may be asking it the first time to the top leadership of the NEF. But we once got a presentation somewhere, I think it was when we went to Kumamani, somewhere, I think in the Van area, NEF presented. What's the name of that presentation? Arcelometa, yeah. And I asked the same question. And I'm not sure if the fault is with these provinces or the NEF does not take those provinces seriously. I come from the rural province of the northwest of South Africa. When NEF reports on any matter, the report about the northwest is just one of the lowest down there. And the other province is it's the Northern Cape. I have raised this thing with the northwest several times as well. I'm not sure where the problem is. Whether they are not coming to say we have projects to do, or whether NEF does not take the serious. That's what I'm not sure of. This is just a simple question of clarity, so that when I make noise out at home there, I should be having the facts and not guessing. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Honorable Slaw.
And once again, I welcome the report.
All right, thank you, Honorable Slaw. I think you have raised the issue of regionalism now.
that of Northwest not being taken care of. And then the CEO raised the issue of the demon of tribalism, which was raised long time ago. And we cannot have a situation in 2013 where the people have to explain their ethnic background, where they come from. I think what is critical, they were having South Africans, but who were treated unequally, and then I think the systems in place are there to address that. So really, the report is good. I concur with my colleagues. The report is good. But what I'd like to say to direct this meeting, on the question which was raised by Ms. Honorable James on the issue of the bonus, I'll expect that to be answered by the chairman of the board, not the CEO herself. Because in good corporate governance, you know, is the board which appraises the CEO. I think that question will go there. And then on the other issue of, or the CEO can ask the issue of being bankrupt, but if any else is bankrupt, I really, really, really appreciate to have that balance to be under a given name. And then I'll be that a nice bankruptcy. Everything can come across. But then you can go through all the questions and then through the questions. And but the other one, which I like from my side, would be the issue of the issue of mentoring. Is your mentoring technique effective? Is it effective? Do you really reevaluate it now and again? So that when you award any loan to any person, I think the effect must be that the people must not go bust. So how effective is your mentoring system? We should say that you are heading there. And then really all the other initiatives are really appreciated. So I think that I don't know who's going to start, the chairperson of the board or the chairperson of the board, and then they see.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairman. Where I will start, Honorable Chair, if you'll allow me, is to address the questions that were posed by Honorable Member McIntosh and also Honorable Member Chair. The CEO will be asked. The first question was whether or not the NES are considered lifted. And I must admit, even though I work for a company now that invests in listed companies, most of my professional background has actually been in the unlisted space, so I've been extremely well spoken. And I certainly right now I don't think the timing is right for NES to do that sort of thing, and mainly because if you look at the underlying investments, they're all very young. And so any investors that would look to put money into the NEF to effectively put a huge discount because they don't have good sight into the cash generation of those underlying investments. So quite honestly, would end up people thinking that the NEF is not performing poorly because there's a huge discount as trading. I think we've got to take baby steps to how we develop the NEF, which is exactly what we're doing. I think the first stage was for us to secure funding from the fiscus. And then, but part of that, we also were able to use our own funds from the MTN shares to fund our operations and our investments. So there was a point when we actually no longer sought funding from the fiscus. We're entering now the second phase, where, and I think we matured enough where we can start to look to raise third-party capital. But that, you know, there are different kinds of, there's private sector third-party and others, and it's much more difficult to raise that third-party now, still too young. So what we've tried to do is to go to the DFIs, particularly the homegrown DFIs. I think it's a sensible approach. They understand what we're doing and then so on, so they can get their arms around us much easier. The next phase, I think, may be to try to attract third-party capital, but maybe from overseas, not just from local. And it may be DFIs and private sector as well, depending on how well we do. And ultimately, if we really think it makes sense to list, we could consider that. But I think it's a long way off. It's a sexy thing, you know, but I don't think it really would be the right thing for us to do. And then, Honourable Member James, you asked two questions. The one was about the NEF itself and its financial position, and then the other was about the CEO and her remuneration, and how we justify that, I guess, in relation to your sense of where we stand financially. I think it's important at the outset, Honourable Members, for me to make perfectly clear that the NEF is not and has not been bankrupt. We're not illiquid, insolvent, or anything like that. In fact, for several years now, the CEO has been mentioning that there will come a time when the NEF will run out of capital, and we should prepare ourselves for that. And then what happened at the beginning of this year, we looked hard into our numbers, not just what we had in our books, but we had to factor in what government expected from us in terms of the amount of investments we'd make over the next year, 2 years, and so on, the size of our organization, all these sorts of things, to then come up with an idea of how much runway we have, given all the money we expect coming in, but we expect to go out. And then considering that against whether or not we thought we'd be able to secure capital from government or from elsewhere to plug these gaps in time. The fact of the matter is, the board and the executive, after several engagements with various levels of government, it became clear to us that if decisions were made at government, then the NEF would have to make decisions themselves. Otherwise, if no one did anything, we would have run out of capital by August of this year. So it was clear to us that more time was needed for us to raise capital from government. And so the NEF had to act. And this is the most prudent decision for us, was to stop investing until to give space to come to arrangement with government. And it also, quite honestly, gave us the opportunity to do a number of other things within the portfolios which we hadn't been able to focus on enough. But we have capital, so some of that capital, there were projects that were already in the pipeline which we had made some commitments to, so we have to, honor those commitments. But we have capital that will allow us to go through this recapitalization question, hopefully for at least another year, maybe even longer, without having to damage this institution. We're not anywhere near being bankrupt. So the second question was around whether or not the CEO's remuneration was deserved, if I summarize it in my own words. And unfortunately, I wasn't here, but a few weeks ago, it was reported to me correctly, I was in this very chamber where I think the CEO was given a standing ovation for the work that the NEF and under her leadership, had performed. But I think more than that, we have to, as a board, be driven by the facts, not just by sentiments. And if you look at the results that the NEF has delivered, and all the executives are remunerated based on performance in the past year, not for forward-looking stuff. And if you judge both the organization's performance, also the CEO performance in terms of broader leadership and what we need to do to recapitalize this entity, it's been exceptional. So we as board had absolutely no difficulty at all in justifying both the salary and the bonus that was paid, not just to her, but also to others within the broader organization. I think by any measure, they have built an exceptional entity and is well positioned to meet countries and governments' priorities.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I'll try and just respond to Honourable Member Sofane Ramerville's question on whether, we are also well positioned to take the concept that you're referring to as the gazelles, where we are saying the concept there is to actually try and duplicate and grow the jobs for the economy. I think, Honorable Sue, that was the rationale for setting up the strategic project fund. If you look at those, most of those projects that we're looking at, there's also the mineral beneficiation one, the RMI, I was talking about the early metals, I was talking about the hospitals. If you look at the job creation potential of those entities, it's well in excess of 100,000 jobs. Some of them will be located here in South Africa, but the long-term vision is to actually also find a way of encouraging them to look into the continent, because the growth strategy should not just be, you know, be focusing on what is available in the local market. Some of them are also partnering with the BRICS countries like China and Russia. I know that the Russians are involved in the RMI project, as an example. The Chinese will be involved in some of the mineral beneficiation projects. So where we're saying, maybe we'll not be in position to actually find all the capital that is required for the investments that we're looking at. And our Chinese counterparts are telling us this is what we've been looking for. And must remember that when they come to South Africa, they are using South Africa as a platform to actually grow into the continent. So I'm just saying, broadly speaking, that is the vision. But obviously, after the meeting, I will request you to give us more information on the results, just to make sure that we understand the concept fully. And then there was a question from Honorable Waile. I think I will ask my colleague Strakalani to respond to that question. There was a question, another question from Honorable Member Phil, where he's inquiring about the few projects basically that we, in your view, that we have invested in that particular front. I think Honorable Silau, the challenge that we have, you know, and this does not just pertain to the NEF, only is across the board, you know, this is what most of the DFIs will be grappling with as well, is that oftentimes for us, what is difficult is to actually go to the provinces to identify, conceptualize, develop the project from scratch without getting the necessary help from the provincial governments. So I think what we need to do as a country, especially when you focus on the provinces that are in the, you know, economically depressed nodes or areas of the country, is to find a partnership model. Because it doesn't matter who you talk to, the IDC will also, you know, express the same frustration. We are also expressing the same frustration where we're saying the provincial governments are the ones who must lead us in terms of identifying those investment opportunities. Because once the investment opportunities exist, I don't think there's anybody who would be, you know, willing not to actually go and invest in those particular provinces. So I don't know where the real, you know, problem is, but with some of the provinces, for instance, I know that we'll even go and talk to the premiers of those provinces or the MCs for economic development and complain, and the local DFIs in other instances would not be willing to actually co-finance the projects with us. I will just quote the Eastern Cape. If you invest in the Eastern Cape, the idea is for the NEF to co-invest with local DFIs like the, I think it's the ECDC. But sometimes you go to the ECDC, you have the appetite to actually go in there and do the investment as the NEF, and then you just get a negative, you know, result or response from some of the local DFIs. I can't remember if we have any local DFIs in the Northwest, but I'm just saying, as a general principle, these are some of the frustrations. What we always encourage the honourable members to do is to channel some of those investment opportunities to us. So if people on the ground, you know, are looking at some opportunities, my team and I are always willing to actually go to those areas, which is why for the first time now we have set up the NEF office in all the provinces, which is something that we never used to have in the past.
Thank you very much, CEO and the Honorable Chairperson. You know, at times when we don't write history, things can come back to actually haunt us. And I really want to put it on record that it was under the leadership of Mrs. Mteto that MEF continued to do business in acquisition transactions and all others. You know, she said, what are we doing in the rural areas? And then there was a death of a unit called Rural and Community Development Fund, which looked at how do we unlock value in these rural areas by not encouraging the status quo in terms of how each province contributes towards the GDP of this country. And I really want to say that as we speak today with all the offices in the regional, in the regions, just in the past financial year that we are reporting on, more than 50% of the volumes that we did originated from the regional offices, where today we are seeing cooperatives. I remember MPH Kango Mamabasa always said cooperatives. Today we can proudly say we have got more, you know, cooperatives that have been funded, showing that it is actually a viable model for anybody to support in the rural areas where we have supported feedlots, broilers, agro-processing, even in the form of, you know, regional shopping centers where communities used to travel more than 100 kilometers to the nearest, you know, town. We have done all of that. I think Honorable Member mentioned the issue of, you know, cooperatives, for instance, for the dairy, you know, sector. We actually, in Mpumalanga, through a partnership with the provincial government, funded a cooperative community, you know, that is actually becoming now owners in a project where through one of the, you know, the multinationals will be an off-taker of milk in that particular province. And the provincial government of that region, you know, injected a number of, injected money to ensure that we can capitalize this project to the right value. In Western Cape, we actually have got an enterprise development fund. You know, a Minister of Finance, Economic Development and Tourism, Alan Wynn, was part of the opening of those, and we have done a sizable number of transactions in this province as well through that partnership. Bakwena, you know, Bamukhopa, Bakata Bakhafela. We have done all of those things in Northwest as well to make sure that communities are the ones that generate the projects, bring them to us, and through enterprise development, we are able to can help them as well. And I think I just want to assure you that in the northern, Northwest, we do have a number of projects, and we believe also in the partnership with Bakhata, Bakhafela, Bakwena, Bamukhopa. We have got something with Khoshimulamu, where we are now, you know, farming, you know, sunflower and so on. These things are happening, and we are excited about it. Northern Cape, we just have a cooperative called Richmond of Commander, where they actually farm in Merilshi. And those are some of the interesting projects that we are happy to be associated with as an institution. Lastly, mentorship. We have taken a deliberate strategy that says every SME transaction that we do, we need to attach mentors to them. Because throwing money into projects without giving black people support on how to manage these businesses, how to market, how to go about ensuring that corporate governance is observed in these businesses will actually be defeating ourselves. And we therefore have got a group, you know, of mentors that are across the width and breadth of this country who are helping us in ensuring that over and above us funding them, they are there to provide a service which is provided for 100% free to those enterprises. And we do an annual evaluation through, you know, our post-investment department of the services that we are getting. And what I want to report on is that we are seeing a lot of progress and actually, you know, performance improving in many of the businesses. One example in the Eastern Cape, we have got a brick manufacturing company that really nearly just went bust. We have attached, you know, an entity that is helping us turn around this particular business. And as we speak now, they're actually starting on a month-to-month basis to show positive, you know, cash flows because of the help of the mentors that we deploy you know, all over the country.
All right, thank you for the answers. If there's anything which was left out, can indicate to the secretary so that they can respond in writing. Yes, sir. But I'd also like to give the COO of DTI a chance to have a bite on this.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to respond to the question about what has been done in terms of recapitalization and reclassification. The CEO raised these concerns, I think, with the department about 2 years ago. She raised it formally, I think, in the annual meetings the ministers had, and there was also a subsequent letter that was sent to the department. The initial focus and the initial engagement with National Strategy and the department was on the reclassification of the entity to move it from a Schedule 3A to looking at a Schedule 2 entity. That process is also still ongoing. And then we've also ramped up the recapitalization of the NF. And I think earlier this year there was an engagement between the chair as well as the DG with senior officials at the department at the Treasury. So the processes are ongoing there, but I think there is a defined process by National Treasury and we are engaged with that process. But this was raised with the department about 2 years ago. Thanks, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Jody. I think members who are coming to an end of this session, but really I think on behalf of the portfolio committee, would like to thank the delegation from the NEF plus the department. What was very important is that the chairperson of the board really assured us that the laws of the country will be followed to the letter and the dignity of the people will be protected. I think that's what is very important. But chairperson, I also like to tell you that you are running a very tight ship there at NEF. You are running a very tight ship, of which I think that all of us here are proud to have this entity as part of the family of the land, of trade industry. I can make a very simple example. You know, last year, during the constituency plot, I visited a school in a rural area. That school was recently built by the department or by the government of the Free State. You know, it's a top-notch school. It's got a laboratory, it's got a computer lab and all those things. But there's one thing which was lacking there. In the administration, there was no computer support for the administration. The ordinary staff members of the NEF put their size, their leave time, repaired some computers which were going to put on the scrapyard, renewed them, took them there to that school. Physical. They took them, those computers, to that school. And then I'm telling you, the results of that school was around 47% the previous year. By the end of last year, it was around 71%. What is speak to the principal is very simple. The administrative burden was removed, was eliminated. Those computers were not new. They were just rejected and refurbished. But the administrative burden was out of the way, so the teachers were able to concentrate on what they're supposed to do to educate our children. So those things are simple. They're not there in the media. But chairperson, that's why I'm telling you, as chairperson of the board, we are running a very tight ship. That's why we're proud to be associated with you as the people. That's the issue of this recap. It's not something new. We know it for some years. We know it for some years. That's why everyone, even with our colleagues in the Treasury, in the Finance Committee, we've already engaged in an appropriation, engaged with them around those issues. So I think that we are going to get the necessary support because the work you're doing is very important. Broad-based economic empowerment. This is the way of life. I understand what Honorable McIntosh is saying, that a Nigerian has got a serious problems with broad-based economic empowerment, but Nigeria has never experienced apartheid. They don't know what, he does not know what he's speaking about. But with these projects which are in the line, I think that you are doing a good job. I think continue, just have grow a thick skin, and then we'll take the country forward. Thanks a lot, everyone. The meeting's adjourned. Tomorrow, we're meeting myself. Yes, tomorrow meeting here? Yeah, at 9 o'clock, National Credit Act Amendment.